Welcome back, Martini Giant fans. This is episode number 139, which is the 2023 film, Poor Things. Of course, that is directed by Yorgos Lanthimos and starring Emma Stone, Mark Ruffalo, and William Dafoe. And we decided to pair that with the 2016 film, Swiss Army Man, which is directed by Daniel Kwan and Daniel Scheiner. And of course, starring Daniel Radcliffe and Paul Dano. A lot of Daniels in this film. A lot of underseen film. And a very interesting pairing. Why do we do these two films? Well, of course, we wanted to do Poor Things. It's been a big Oscar thing that's happened for a long time. We actually love Yorgos Lanthimos' films and really want to cover this film for obvious reasons. The Swiss Army Man actually came as a suggestion from a friend of mine, Chris. And he said he liked the film, and I said, okay, I'll watch it. And then I was like, ah, this is a perfect pairing for this. These are, yes, very Frankenstein-type films. A lot of people, comedy about dead people in some ways that involves dead people or reanimated people. And kind of interesting to sort of think about what that means. But I love these films. I also really like the fact that Swiss Army Man is a very important film. People had not seen it. The Daniels did Everything Everywhere. And a lot of people had not necessarily seen A Swiss Army Man. And I think it's highly underrated. Also a film that shows that you can do amazing things with an extremely small budget, which I also really, really appreciate. Okay, a couple things I want to say. We have obviously just been a few breaks here and there with the podcast because Martini Giant has been extremely busy. As you guys know, we are in the middle of a production for a short film. We are doing it in combination with Chaos and the Innovation Lab. And this is specifically centered around us doing a production that involves the actual Project Arena, which is a new type of technology that's being developed at the Chaos Innovation Lab for virtual production. And having Martini Giant being part of it on the creative side of things is really a joy. I get to work on the technical side of things as well as the creative side of things. Really, really exciting. So Daniel is directing it. Eric is doing production design on it. I'm doing the producing on it. All three of us are starring in it, and all three of us are actually the writers of it as well. And it's really very much the story is centered around Martini Giant's ethos on filmmaking, which I think is really, really cool. So very excited to tell you more about that as that's coming along. But just look forward to it. I mean, we're going to start talking more and more about it. We'll probably end up talking about it in upcoming episodes as we go. Speaking of upcoming episodes, I don't think we have picked what we're going to do this Saturday. As you guys know, we usually record on Saturdays and we usually do them as live streams, which will be April 27th. We'll either do a watch party or do an actual episode of a podcast. Haven't quite picked that out yet, but just make sure and follow us on either our Twitch channel, which is twitch.tv/martini_giant, twitch.tv/martini_giant. But if you would like to just follow us on YouTube, that's also an option. We're live streaming on YouTube at the same time, which is youtube.com/@martinigiant, youtube.com/@martinigiant. And we do our live streams there. Again, they happen on Saturdays at usually 3 p.m. Pacific Standard Time is when we don't have those happen. But for now, please enjoy episode number 139, which is Poor Things and Swiss Army.
Like here's the only reason why I'm motivated to watch Oscars. I actually think this is one of the best years we've had in films. 2023 year of filmmaking was one of
it's
the best.
It's
years
a good year. It's a very good year. Yep. Like I think that I wonder. Do you guys think that the movies that are represented in the Oscar 10 are representative of the best movies of the year? Or are there outsiders that you would prefer beyond that list?
There probably are outsiders.
They are outsiders.
Yeah. They're always, and that's the thing. And after years of doing that, you're like, it kind of doesn't help, right? It doesn't make you love it when you're like, God, how come that didn't get picked? Like Barbie got snubbed.
Yeah, no, it's in
the, and I love Barbie, and I love Greta Gerwig and Noah Baumbach. I'm right. Like, why would you even think about that? And they made a new category, which is like, really?
Yeah, like when the Golden Globes came up with the movie that made the most money award or whatever.
Yeah, sorry, that was the Golden Globes. But the point is, it's just making shit up as you go, which at the end.
They made a casting category, didn't they?
Yeah, I think that's new this year.
Casting agents deserve it, though.
Yeah, absolutely. I think casting is. I think casting and stunts need to be up there, and stunts, they're still arguing for
stunts. Casting is very hard to do, and a lot of people do it so well, and it makes the movie.
Absolutely.
So I'm for that. But I just think this. We snubbed you in one category, so we're going to make up a new one.
Well, the way in which the Oscars are genuinely meaningful is that it's kind of like a snapshot of culture in the moment.
That's right.
Right. And so, like, I'm not the biggest fan of Barbie, but I think that Barbie, you know, like, that needs to be in the mix because it was not only a monstrous hit, it was a monstrous hit for real reasons that are important to people. And I think that it's good to have that stuff, like, whether I think the movie was of a particular standard or not doesn't really make any difference. It's like this is very important culturally, and this is a window into where we're at in 2023, 2024. And so I think that's valid enough by itself. You know, like there's you know, every year there's better movies than most of the movies that are nominated. But it's talking about us as a culture, film as a cultural thing. And it's a document of that. So I appreciate the Oscars in that way. I think that it's like my patience for, say, like award speeches has worn super thin.
Oh my God. It's like watching a freaking Trump rally.
Yeah. It's weird. It just gets like, it gets weird for me. And
it doesn't need to be.
Yeah. Yeah. And like, I think that it's like, much of the Oscars is waiting to feel, the moment when someone embarrasses themselves. And that's what, like, most of it I'm on tenterhooks going, oh, no.
Did you see Patrick, what's his name? Pascal, what's his name? The guy in Last of Us.
The guy in The Last
Pascal.
Of Us. Something. Oh, Pedro Pascal. Yeah. Yep.
He was
yep.
super drunk when he got his award.
Yeah, he said
did
so.
You see that?
That's really great. I think that's charming.
Like, he did not expect to win, and so I got really drunk, and so I'm sorry. And
that's amazing. God bless you, Pedro Pascal. How could you be more adorable than that? That's incredible.
Yeah. Rankle 37 asks us if we are declaring 2023 a vintage year. Aha, vintage as in like a fine wine vintage.
Yeah, like is
yes,
that well? Like,
I do I think would, that's like, a good
every,
way to put
every
it.
Every movie
actually.
That's nominated, it's unusual that every movie that's nominated is at least a pretty good movie. Mm-hmm. You know, that's a rare thing. I don't know if I agree that like of all the movies that were nominated, like there are a couple that like there are many that received like really 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 high praise, and I was like, I guess so. Like it right. didn't totally hit for me. So I don't feel the energy of like when, say, There Will Be Blood and No Country for Old Men were up in the same year and that kind of stuff, where it's like, these are truly great films. And I think that I think that Oppenheimer is a incredibly well-made movie, and I think that deserves to be out there. I love The Holdovers in a very like old school, certain type of film kind of way. I think that's great. But the big ones, like I was not a giant fan of Scorsese's movie. I love Scorsese, but it didn't land for me as well as I would have wanted it to. And there's a number of movies in the list that I felt that way about.
Hmm. Well, it was interesting. I had some mixed feelings. Barbie getting snubbed, I was like, meh. Honestly, and because to me, and it comes back to what we're doing on podcasts, is the Poor Things, mm-hmm. I thought was a much more powerful feminist statement than Barbie.
It's a much more on point. It's certainly like I both agree with it more, so it's easier for me to like it. And also like it really feels challenging and experimental and strange.
Sure.
Yes.
Which I just like better as a, you know, like if you're going to make a movie, like go for it. And it really goes for it. And yeah. I feel like, like, you know, I won't relitigate Barbie, but I think that Barbie has excellent stuff in it. And I really,
too.
You know, and yeah. I think that there's lots of like, Like, I particularly love Gosling. I think he's hysterical.
Well, the problem I have is, like, people say, I can't believe Barbie got snubbed. I was like, well, did you see the other movies? No.
Well, there you go.
And it's like, and I said, my daughter brought this up, and she said, well, is there only limited people, limited nomination? I said, yes. And he goes, oh.
Yeah.
It's like, Poor Things was a better movie than Barbie if you...
It's certainly in the ballpark.
I thought Barbie, if you take at the source, it's a doll meant to be a feminist icon back at the time.
Sure.
It was right. to empower teen girls or whatever age they were planning for. For what she did with the source material was extraordinary.
I completely agree. I'm like, it's such an uphill battle to make that as good a movie as it is.
Absolutely. And to deal with corporations and the branding history.
Like,
it's an extraordinary.
You're making
feat.
A giant ad for Mattel, and you have to try to make it into a good movie. That is a
well,
very
they're
tall.
They're all ads in a way for the studio.
Better than Transformers.
Well, yeah, like yeah, it's like it's this is like all movies are ads. I understand that, but this is an ad. Like it is an ad
it
for
is,
Barbie
but
products.
She carved out something unique yeah. under the guise of an
doing
ad.
Something that has any meaning at
and
all
she gave
in that context.
Life to these inanimate
right.
objects.
I agree.
And
I agree.
There were some bad moments. The Will Ferrell stuff I thought was dopey, but yeah. I definitely think that's great filmmaking.
Yeah, she's a great filmmaker. I love her. I'm a huge fan of her Little Women, and I love her as an actor and a writer. Frances Ha is like, I've seen it like a trillion times.
Frances Ha.
Yeah. And so like these, like I have absolute, I have great admiration for Greta Gerwig. And I think that she did a job she took on a job that's very, very hard. And that it came up to me with mixed results is not surprising given what the task was. But yeah, there's stuff in there that's admirable.
And for the studio, it made a lot of money.
It made a ton of money. And people obviously wanted to have this experience, and that's why there was so much energy behind it. I think
to
it was
characters that are still quotable.
Yeah.
Like Ken.
Oh, Ken's the home run of the movie. Like that's the thing that I love.
But the thing that was funny about that is he got nominated, which he should have, but then they didn't nominate Margot Robbie, and everyone goes like, "Oh, you see?" I'm like, "Wait, what?"
Well,
he stole the movie, though.
He steals the movie. Like, I mean, she gives it. Like the fact is that she get both Margot Robbie and Greta Gerwig gave the movie to him. Like, it's the best written part. They give him all the room in the world to do the best he can, and I think that Robbie's doing a great job. As Barbie, but it's kind of a heavy lift compared
but
to what
his job is to make them look good.
Yeah.
But he does it by stealing the show.
Yeah.
But he's a really great, great comic.
He's tremendous across the board. And the thing is, like, I also love Margot Robbie. I think that, like, she should win for things like Once Upon a Time in Hollywood, where she doesn't have a lot of lines and she's that good. That's real stuff. Mm-hmm. You are leaning entirely on your presence and performance at that point when you only have a few lines, but you're in a lot of the movie.
She should get two Oscars, one for each of her filthy feet.
This is very true. I'm getting Quentin Tarantino presents, but with this, like she will, if it were to win Best Picture, she would receive the Oscar. She made the movie. Like she is like Margot Robbie produced the movie. Like that's her work. So I think that she deserves big credit for that. And, my critique of the movie aside, cause it's, for me, it's a big mess and much of it's very boring, but the high points are real high points. And Greta Gerwig remains a superstar in my book in terms of her abilities. So this is all excellent.
All right. Let's get to these movies. I really love Poor Things. I was very excited to see this because, I loved Lobster, as we've discussed on the podcast before.
And Yorgos Lanthimos fan myself, yes.
Yorgos Lanthimos fan. And, he does very indie style stuff, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. And this is indie style, but way more.
He does it his way, man.
But it's way more. This is like a high budget. This is the highest, by far the highest budget film he's ever done.
Oh, yeah.
Right?
Yeah, big stars, like lavish production, and he's I will go out on a limb and say, like, he made a movie with this that didn't feel the way I expected it to in any way. It didn't feel like previous. It has a slight flavor of his previous work, but it felt more like, if you had told me Wes Anderson and Tom Waits got together and made a movie, I'd be like, oh yeah, that makes sense. it was an entirely different flavored thing than his previous work, which I really actually admired. I thought it was a nice turn for him. Because you can say the Favorite and The Lobster have a much the same continuous tone.
I think my favorite of his is The Killing of the Sacred Deer.
Right. Yeah, exactly. Exactly.
That is a beautiful film. So great.
He is. Especially in that and in The Lobster, he has a real knack for getting that same flavor that Kubrick did. I'm not sure how to describe it, but it's like
undertone.
It's an undertone that
binds everything. And it's not just a visual undertone that's bound by visuals from frame to frame, but there's this undertone which you get really from scene to scene in a Scorsese film, or you get in a John Huston film. It's just this weird, or Tarantino, and it's not the way the actors are standing or the way it looks so much, but there's some undertone that you're just like, that's his style. And maybe undertone is style, but that's what it is. There's something to explain.
Yeah, there's something like he creates this very rich, rich world, but slightly at a distance. It feels very real and very, very, looking through a telescope the entire time.
First of all, we should before we dive too much into it, we're going to pair this with Swiss Army Man, which is a movie that I saw after that. And I was like, I'll just check it out. And I think why the hell didn't we know more about this movie? This movie is awesome. I know that Eric hasn't seen either one. But we're going to get into Swiss Army Man later. But I do want to say that is a very important movie as well that I think would be very exciting to talk. But we're going to start with Poor Things. Because I think there's something there. But I think the thing to me about Poor Things, it was immediately it had a City of Lost Children vibe to it.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. That's a good call. It's adjacent. It's not the same, but it's adjacent.
Not the same. Yeah. By the way, I'm watching this, and I'm like, this is the first film designed by Midjourney.
Sure.
You think?
Yeah.
Oh yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. There's a lot of that.
It's somebody who's Midjourney and using it right now as we talk. Mm-hmm. There is a way, the interiors are composed, and the mixing of this kind of Spanish style in the 20s or 30s. I forget that guy's name, but there was just the way, just the wall details and the finishings. It was God, they ran these. Their base ideas came from Midjourney. Even the exterior of the building. It's
everything
international style mixed with Victorian.
The way they execute the style doesn't make sense unto itself.
But I was like, that is so Midjourney. And my wife's like, that's like Midjourney. And I was like, you're right. It is.
That's interesting.
So there is this kind of, I don't know if they used it in design, but if you look at, go to interiors and look at interiors from Midjourney, and you look at some of those interiors, the way the walls were had that kind of bas relief detail, but it was like, what are those patterns? And they're mixed with. So there was definitely a lot of that, which I thought was great because I love Midjourney, but it's its own style.
Yep. No, it's interesting. I mean, I bet if they did use Midjourney, the studio is like, do not tell anyone you use Midjourney.
Right.
or else we'll lose the Oscar. But you mean that entirely in a positive way. There's a bizarre.
Yeah, but
it's a tool, right?
It's a tool.
Choice.
It's a tool. Right.
So it's not Midjourney to make it.
Was a source of inspiration.
Yep.
Absolutely.
Yep. Yeah, I think that's true.
And also the boat looked like the Fifth Element boat.
Yes.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, very much so. Yeah. Yeah. Like the big floating airship.
I actually had huge problems with the miniatures.
So did I.
Interesting.
And I thought that purple sky was bad.
I did too.
Mm-hmm.
I think there was a certain choice about going a little stylized and crazy. But I almost feel like they were almost congratulating themselves for using miniatures. And they looked shitty. And they definitely forgot about how to make good-looking miniatures.
Yeah.
But like, it's almost like, you see, we did it as a miniature. It's exciting. Right. Yeah. It's like, I can tell it's a miniature and it looks kind of shitty.
Yeah, like I think there's an intention to make it look art, like small and artificial. And
doesn't
fake.
Matter.
But
there's
like
ways of making that to still looks beautiful.
Right.
And it didn't.
Right. Yeah, like I think that it looks like, yeah, there's a little bit of like, Wes Anderson actually
does this.
I think we
forgot how to make good miniatures, though.
Well, like, all the craftsmen are gone because of CG people.
Well, yeah, like, Wes Anderson handles this stuff extremely well.
That was a very Wes Anderson film, by the way.
Yeah. And so, it has a very, like, Wes Anderson, when he does this stuff, like, even when things are very intentionally manufactured or stop motion-y or whatever he's doing, you know, like, there's an intense amount of visible craft going on. And I do agree that Poor Things kind of lands in an awkward middle ground where, like, if it looked more rickety and crafted, it would have been to the movie's benefit. And I can't really, like, I think that it's sort of like they either should have pushed that a little harder or made it work better. So I bought it more. Like, buy it less or buy it more. But where it's at is sort of like an in-between space that makes me feel unfinished. I think that's
The one thing for me that really felt Wes Anderson were all those drawings. The way they use the drawings is like this character in its own way unfolding, and the way they did it, it wasn't just a piece of paper with information for the cast or about what's going on. It was a piece of paper with a drawing that was like in presentational style. It was just Wes Anderson.
Right.
When you saw all those, and the drawings were great, but I just was like, that's a little bit of Wes Anderson going on here.
Yeah. Jason asks if it's Logan's Run City bad. I'm like, well, that's not that bad, but yes, it's in the same ballpark. If anyone's seen Logan's Run recently, that won for best visual effects in 1976, and then Star Wars won the next year. You can see the difference between those two is steep. Yeah. It's quite steep.
Yeah.
But that said, I still enjoy Logan's Run. But yeah, like I think you're right. Like the Wes Anderson vibe is actually, it doesn't just take a lot of work. It's a lot of work on display. And this was a little, this looked a little bit more high school playish than a bunch of crafting professionals. I agree with you on that. It was interesting looking, but undercooked.
Yeah. If you go back again and look at things like City of Lost Children.
Yeah.
Then that was very, better executed.
Yeah. Very detailed.
That was a much older film.
Yeah. And now we're again for the audience, like we're not talking about the convincingness of the effect.
Nope.
They were talking about whether it's kind of shabby or whether it's obviously made by pros.
It doesn't have to look. We're not trying to say it looks photoreal or is believable. Right. I'm just saying it's well crafted and well done. Right.
Yeah. Because like I really,
we
like,
all
I
know
love,
that this is supposed to look stylized. Right.
Right. Like one of my favorite examples of this, like I think that Life Aquatic does this incredibly well. Like, and Life Aquatic has things in it that are specifically stop motion animation in the middle of a live action film. But they're so lushly cared for in terms of the handcrafting detail that's what makes it work. You're just like, oh, that's totally fake in a beautiful way. And I think they don't quite achieve what they're going for in that respect, which is weird from Lanthimos because when he's shooting in more real world situations, the density, and the depth of his production design is really,
I think that's
extreme.
Right. But there's not a lot of effect shot. Wes Anderson is an illustrator, director, writer, director, illustrator. He's not Yorgos,
Lanthimos.
He's not an illustrator. Right. He doesn't think in those terms but that's why Killing a Sacred Deer is a master for me, but there's no, he put a tool set that he wasn't natural in.
Yeah,
which
I think
was
that's right.
That kind of presentational, and he relied heavily on set design and other tricks. That's why I think the lensing thing in this, I understood it, but
it was all over the place on purpose.
Yeah.
Right?
On purpose, but again, not completely coherent in its vision.
Not coherent. And not I coherent. Think because he's not a visual.
Also, can we talk about the fact that everyone's going to to Eastern Europe and buying all these weird Russian lenses and putting them on cameras?
Yes.
That's what all those things are. It's all those weird, deep, weird, ringy, defocused things.
Shits, yeah. Dog shits lenses in Germany.
Yeah.
And they get them. But it's S-H-I-T-Z, dog shits lenses.
That's it.
So it really, was funny. When I was in Sofia with our good friend Daniel Buck, who, as you guys know, is a big camera guy, we're walking around the main plaza area, which is where people, you know, if tourists in Sofia would go to. And there's a whole street full of guys that are selling old Russian cameras, and there's just tons of them because know that American tourists or Western or tourists come by, and that's what they want to buy, which I think is kind of funny. Which I, you know, the lenses used on this movie might have come from that location. Just putting it.
Well, down. I mean, I think there's something to it. It's like Soderbergh actually collects really shitty lenses. He loves bad lenses and cracked lenses and all this kind of stuff. And he keeps like a bag of them, and he tests them out for whatever he's doing. And it's because he likes finding like weird anomalies or flares or the coating's bad or whatever it is. And if
Daniel had one that was radioactive,
I'm sure that makes an impression on the film.
Yeah,
like eats away the emulsion as you're shooting. That's
It was a lens that was used in a World War II spy plane. It was a massive lens for low light, and it had a coating on it that was painted with a.
That sounds like an astonishing Daniel Buck style find, right?
Yeah.
He got it shipped to him, and it was completely illegal.
Try not to ship radioactive elements. Like, you have those delivered in a much more.
There might have been in this. Way. I mean, you know, obviously people were definitely affected by radiation in this film.
Yeah, that's very true.
With a tumor. That's very true. And taking out his own tumor. That was pretty funny.
So do we want to talk about the story of the film?
We do want to talk about the story of the film and who's in it and how did it get made. I mean, yes, we do. I will tell you this. I am did not scrugs these films because I saw them both, but I did not rewatch them recently because I've been juggling a lot. And on my memory of having seen this in theaters when it came out.
It's been a little bit not the distance for me. I recently saw Poor Things. I probably saw Swiss Army Man a year-ish ago. So it's like I'm not quite up to speed on it, but I remember
the breakdowns for you.
Yeah.
We can help with I do remember poor we can all break down, but Eric will definitely correct us if we forget something.
Yes, please.
But it starts off, how does it start, Eric, since you saw probably most recently?
Victorian London, a medical student.
Right.
Max McCandles becomes assistant to this Godwin Baxter. She calls Godwin, and he has a kind of somebody he oversees or considered a ward that the doctor oversees. And it's what's her name?
Emma Stone.
Yeah.
But he's a doctor, and you can notice he's got all these scars on his face, right?
Right.
Yeah.
So it alludes to this Frankenstein.
It's William Dafoe plays that doctor.
Yep.
Yeah, and it's sort of like, I think Eric was about to say, like, it's an inversion of the Dr. Frankenstein thing, where he is the Dr. Frankenstein figure, but he looks like the Frankenstein's monster.
Yeah. Yes.
Right.
She is beautiful. She's Emma Stone. But she is the creature, and he is the doctor.
Right. And there is an assistant, right, Eric?
Yes, and he's a medical student
right.
for the doctor at the university.
Mm-hmm.
And he has him kind of, because the doctor, Willem Dafoe, he operated on her and replaced her brain with the brain of a woman killed herself. And
that's what
pregnant.
We found out in the beginning, yes, a woman killed herself.
And she's carrying child. And so they pull her out of the river.
Yeah,
he takes the brain of the child and puts it into the woman, who is now Emma Stone.
We don't find out about this until later, but she acts like a child, even though she's an adult woman.
She is her body's own child.
Right.
That's the way to say it, right? Like, so she is the woman who committed suicide, but she was pregnant. The brain of the baby that would have been delivered was put in the head of the woman that died.
We find this out about the end of the second act. But we kind of suspect something like this the whole time.
So post facto spoilers.
Right.
But that's
we're
going
to spoil the movie for anyway. So But yes, but we don't know about this until later. But she acts like a child. She's bumbling around. She's awesome.
Yeah, she's fucking terrific. Emma Stone's great.
She is so good.
Yeah. Yeah. And like I respect that. Like I don't necessarily buy into when actors – I act also, so I'm not just slamming actors, but like when actors get up and talk like in a mystical fashion about acting and they say how brave something is and all this stuff, I'm like, a lot of it sounds like baloney. A lot of the time it sounds like baloney. But what I do appreciate in actors is a fuck it, let's do this attitude. And she definitely has it. Like so we're talking about the same thing. It is the bravery aspect, but I don't look at it as just like, oh, she's so brave. Like, you know, she's, you know, like Joan of Arc. I look at her as just like, she knows what acting is, and she's not letting her ego get in the way. You know, like she's really fucking going for it. I appreciate that artistically.
This isn't a Nicole Kidman overdramatic acting scenario. Right. This is like, fuck it. Yeah. Let's just fuck.
Yeah,
because
exactly.
That's what needs to be done.
Exactly. Like, and I think that this is the thing is, I think that actors like often find themselves, it's like the difference between method acting as it is commonly seen today versus what Daniel Day-Lewis does. Like Daniel Day-Lewis is a method actor, but he's not doing it in some showy way so he gets acclaim for being a method actor. Like he just says things like, I'm going to do the accent all the time so I don't lose the accent. You know, I'm going to try to physically present this way so I don't lose my stride in what I'm trying to do so we can get it done quicker. Mm-hmm. You know, like, I think that's just, you know, that's people's process and that helps. That's fantastic. Mm-hmm. But when people have a process that is about how brave they are for having a process or whatever the fuck it is, like, go do something else. This is not about, you know, this isn't like applause school. You know, like acting is difficult. Treat it like a job and you'll do better. And I think that she has a good ferocious mindset about taking on that craft that I really appreciate. Whether you want to call it brave or not. Like, good work, Emma. I appreciate what you're doing. That's amazing.
But she's stumbling around. And what is the young doctor's job at this point?
Her father, Godwin, or the young father? He's basically working as an assistant for the doctor.
But he's supposed to watch the girl, right? Like babysit her or monitor her?
More
or
for study, to see her, how she progresses.
Observe and record what she does.
Yeah, but I think it was more he knew that she possibly would fall in love, or at least it's somebody that could take care of her, knowing that he might be gone someday. Mm-hmm. That was my interpretation. So he does fall in love with her. And so the young assistant, Max McCandles, basically proposes to her. She says, she says yes. And
but she's growing really quickly too, right? So she goes from literally like toddler to teenager pretty quickly.
Right.
And when she gets to her teenage years,
she gets really
horny.
Literally.
Yeah, which is hysterical.
She discovers masturbation, runs.
And she's utterly unself-conscious about this, which is
That's the thing about her. She's unself-conscious about anything.
Yeah, she's like, why would I be? Who cares?
Who cares? Look, you should try this. She tells the maid, like, here, she like shoves her hand up in his crotch. Like, this feels really good.
This is fantastic. We should enjoy these things. And the movie is loaded to the gills with nudity and sex galore.
Yes.
And all of it is unapologetic and unembarrassed. And that's what makes it exciting and fun.
But it's also, thank God, we have some movie that's sex positive.
Oh my God, it's fucking killing me. I'm just like, this is like, and the thing is, like, you look at the negative reactions to this movie, it's
sounds like you have a show. Sex positive.
Sex positive. Like the negative reactions to this show, which come from a much wider range of ages than you would expect. Like,
of course.
Heavily loaded towards the young. Like, they are very angry and embarrassed that there's so much sex in this film. And I'm like,
really?
What happened to us?
We used to seek it out like kids, man.
Like, when did all this radical self-consciousness become so prevalent? And
do you remember watching Trading Places over and over again just to make sure we could see her
like, freeze frame,
the nudity?
The thing is, like, the idea
we had on VHS tapes, it'd be like, zzz, gzz,
right. So much of the negative dialogue in this film is that Emma Stone is a bad person for portraying so much sex on film, because sex is should be very, very private and to advertise this like this is only to objectify women and to and
you know, it basically does the exact opposite of that.
It's like, yes, exactly. Like to demystify all this and be unselfconscious about something that is beautiful and amazing and good for you is
great
the way that
you, probably.
Yeah. Like this is a healthy way to look at this stuff. Mm-hmm. As opposed to this incredibly guarded and very, very judgy way that many people are like, there's a whole, as we talked about before, like online, there's a huge discourse about like all these sex scenes in films make me very, very uncomfortable. And shit like Saltburn, which I enjoyed, was shocking. I'm like, what is going on, guys?
I know.
What's happening?
Oh, well, guys, let me be honest with you. Something is going on because I have just gotten since Thursday a series of emails from Pinterest because I have my own Pinterest thing for years now, like 10 since it started, and I collect images in a category of like films and people I'd love to have met and you know great this and that and great painters, and I have a section of just what's this
photography and stuff.
Yeah, and I have a section for just the female body, and somebody is coming after me because, like, all of a sudden, all my pins are being taken away, and I will put in the.
This
Twitch,
is for anatomy stuff that you're studying for drawing, right?
Well, it's naked girls, but the point is, it's just like I wrote a letter to once, like, you know, why can't an artist do a nude portrait? Because it's just women posing.
Yeah,
right?
Not even below the belt. I mean, like, because like, I'm for everybody. Everybody be naked.
Four.
Everybody have
so
sex. It's a movie. Let's have fun.
Rampage. It's usually one person, right. And that's what they're responding to. So they're going through my stuff, and I just sent my links, all my pins, and man, am I getting hit.
That's wild, dude. That's sad. I think that's sad. You know, and I think it creates an incredibly, I think it only increases the damage they're trying to avoid when people act like this. Like they're weaponizing something that is healthy, and I think this movie fights against it pretty successfully.
All men are rapists.
Yeah, remember? Exactly.
That's the thing. That's the Sharia law, and he's absolutely right. That's where it comes from.
Well, the thing is that, we don't have to go deep to find, like, yes, I mean, like, there's sexual violence and all sorts of horrible things. We shouldn't let the fact that these things exist make us think that the part that's bad is the sex. Mm. Like, the part that's bad is the hideous violence, selfishness, and abuse, which is bad even without the sex. Like, that's the source of that badness.
There are several interesting male figures that appear in Emma Stone's life from very different points of view.
Right.
Many men.
Mm-hmm.
And they all represent different things that are an important part of her journey as a woman in power of her own body.
And it's
of
a very
her own choices.
Yeah. And it's a very I think better than other films recently who have tried to do this. This is a very healthy, funny, and
it's very funny.
Love it. It's a loving criticism of men as well. Like
it is.
This is a
and the
this
need
is,
of men.
Yeah, like these, like the men that are in this movie, like are flawed. Every single one of them is deeply flawed, like radically flawed. Some of them are irretrievably flawed. Some of them are sadly flawed. Some of them are like pathetically flawed and very funny. But it's a very empathic view of why these guys are fucked up. And we just go like, this fucking idiot. And like, it basically minimizes their excuses to act badly.
Right.
And just reveals them as, when they show that
side of weakness, they feel it's a plus in order to try to win them back or power.
Right. And especially watching the journey of Mark Ruffalo,
which we'll get into in a second.
Yeah.
But
it's really, really, really clever.
But
and
I think
very deeply written.
They don't lecture you about these people. You just
Yeah, you're just watching it happen.
Obviously on the screen, you interpret it the way you want to, but they're very clear about it. They don't have to tell you, by the way, you are an idiot because A, B, C. No.
Right. Yeah, all of the men in this movie try desperately to control her in all the standard ways by which men try to control others and women, right?
Right.
And the movie is just like, no. Like, right. And that's just her response. Like, well, fuck off.
Yeah.
Like,
well, no. Which is the appropriate response. Right away, right? It's not just. It's not no. They had to build up to that no.
Right.
And it took really the real scene where she stood up for herself. She was holding arms with another woman.
Yeah, exactly.
So there was definitely this.
Like she is saying no before she even recognizes the context. Like,
right.
You don't get to tell me what to fucking do.
Right.
Based her point of view from the get-go, even before she understands what's happening.
Sure.
Because, you know, when she's a little child mind, she's still like, no.
Right.
You know?
In the film, the guy wants to marry her. William Dafoe has a contract written up for her, right? Hires a lawyer to write up the contract, played by Mark Ruffalo, right? Who's hilarious.
Unbelievably
steals
funny.
The show.
He is the Ken of this movie.
He is the Ken of this movie. Absolutely. One of my favorite lines in the movie, because he's an idiot, right? That's the whole point. And she writes the contract, which is all written in this big calligraphy in this big parchment, right?
Right.
And William Dafoe is going over it with a magnifying glass. He goes, there's several spelling errors in this contract. That shouldn't affect the validity of the contract.
And he's adopted this great voice where he sounds like a dumbass, but he thinks he sounds really smart all the time. And it's,
don't call me stupid.
He's totally that guy. You're right.
I know Kevin a lot Klein. About the world. Just like you ding.
Kevin Klein in Fish Called Wanda.
Yeah, exactly.
But yes, and while he's doing that, he realizes, like, this contract's about this girl. She must be really special. And he looks at her, and he spies on her, and she's masturbating in a bedroom. And he goes, Bob, that's what I want. And so he says, proposes to her to go away with her. And then she says, but you're engaged to me. And he goes, yeah, so what?
Right.
I'm still going to go with this guy.
I don't give a shit. Fuck you. Like, your problem is not my problem. So,
goodbye. I'll be back. See you later. I'm going on vacation with this guy who clearly is just wants to have sex with me. And I'm okay with that.
That's fine, because that's fun.
And it was like, what? Okay. She's not protecting herself at all.
She just refuses to let anybody else's issues be her problem.
Right.
Like, I mean, and she, like, sometimes she's sort of trapped in a situation. But even then she's like, well, you're not going to get what you want out of me.
Right.
So fuck off. Right. You know, it's sort of hysterical to see somebody do this, because anybody, when you're in a bad situation or you're in some sort of codependent relationship with somebody else, like, you try to figure out ways to be like, make sure the other person is happy in some way, becoming cognizant of what they're going. And she's just like, no, I don't have time for any of that. I'm doing what I want and you can do what you want, but I don't owe you anything.
Right.
And the movie is so thorough in saying that over and over and over and over again. But yet it's always very surprising that it does.
Yep.
Like, because the scenes get more and more ridiculous and she's still like, no.
No.
Yeah. Yeah. So they go to Portugal, right? They get on a boat.
Lisbon,
which is in Portugal, I believe.
Mm-hmm.
go around. And he's trying to power up her, and then she says, well, what are we going to do now? And he goes, siesta, right? Takes her up to the room, and they have wild sex all the time. At which point she goes, why don't people do this all the time? It feels so good.
Exactly.
And then she's like, let's go to him. And he's like, oh, hold on, I need some rest. It's like,
oh, man.
What the fuck? I don't need rest. Yeah. Why do you need rest?
Done it three times. And then, and he's just like, well, I can't just do that again, you know? And she's like, why not? And he's like, well, because there's certain biological blah, blah, blah. And she goes, so is this a general flaw in men? And he goes, I guess. Because, like, the rest of the time he's bragging about what a, you know, like,
what a big lover he is.
And then when it comes down to it, but But you can't. You only get so much gas, right, buddy?
Because I'm ready to go again. I took my 5 minutes.
Yeah, there it is.
You need a nap? What the fuck is wrong with you?
And that encapsulates the movie's point of view virtually perfectly. Yeah. And I think that like, and I feel like this is from Emma Stone. I mean, sex or no sex, like this is a, she wanted to make this movie very much, and I believe that this is her own personal ideal in terms of how to live one's life. Like, it's such a forceful,
yeah, you know, I do what
statement.
I want.
I do what right? I want.
And
I
so as an actress, she's like, I'm going to do that. You can't right. tell me that's wrong thing to do.
Yeah. Right. And so like, this is like, so like when we compared Barbie to this, like I, you know, there's ups and downs for me and Barbie. Like, what I appreciate, where I deeply agree with this movie versus Barbie is that like Barbie, you know, America Ferrera's big speech about how difficult it is to be a woman today is the day and age. I'm like, I appreciate this, but the movie doesn't seem to, it's just like, it puts all of its, like it frames it and then says, just kind of implies that this must be somebody else's fault. And it's out of her control that this is happening. And whereas this movie is just like, this is in your control. And the way out of it is for you to ignore these fucking morons.
Right.
You know, and I'm just like, well, I think that's a healthier state.
Out of being naive and then not becoming naive, I think it was more of that than this is
right.
She's very naive and she's learning, but she impulsively, like a child, just does what she wants.
I think that's very well put, because like it isn't that she knows this and it's here to teach us this. She's just, her naivete is revealing of something very smart. Like,
oh yeah, and that's exactly what it is.
Yeah, and I think that
that's the mix of the brain of a child's brain and a woman's body.
Yeah, exactly. And like, there's a truth in her naivete that other people have lost.
But what's funny is that it's the true child, right? A lot of men want an immature girl
because of their own ego flaws. They want
right, and they're right. like, oh no, because then I can manipulate a child. Child is not manipulated easily,
no,
in that way.
Yeah. And I think that this is it's very like, and again, another thing that people like hate about this movie is like, I've read many people saying like, this movie is disgusting, it's basically about men getting to have sex with a baby. I'm like, is it okay? Let me tell you something about metaphors. let's
where
say
do you read what, about these people.
This is all of Twitter. It's all film Twitter. It's so much nonsense. It's
you
amazing.
Really have to get off that thing.
I do it because of the podcast. It's research.
Bullshit.
But like, this is the kind of dialogue that people have, rather than going, I wonder what this means in terms of my life, as opposed to saying this must be literally meant. And I don't know why people jump towards literalism so directly when something is so obviously metaphorical. But this is it is a wonderful metaphor, and it's a very, very clear-minded statement of a movie. And I think that I feel like anyone who watches this is going to, you know, think through their own choices because of it. Mm-hmm. And that's why I like the movie so much. I have some critiques about the movie, but I think that that's the overall,
I have critique in terms of like, there's some beautiful art direction that's constantly interrupted by other crap.
Yeah. Yeah.
That's
I thought the art direction was
inconsistent.
Yes. And not strong in certain areas. Derivative.
Yeah.
And not focused.
Yeah, I agree.
I think you could say that the intention was that it was a little disjointed because this is a Frankenstein movie, right?
Yeah. Yeah. But
they didn't do it. They didn't execute it.
The Lisbon exteriors were just strange and not thought out. The boat stuff was.
Yeah.
It didn't have the like, because you want something like this to have like a really, given what it's saying and what it's doing in every other way, is so in command of itself. The art direction doesn't rise to that occasion the way that it should. It's just novelty, right? Mm-hmm. Whereas like when we saw Dune 2, like, when you get to the black and white part of Dune 2, like, it's thrilling just to see someone make such a hardcore artistic decision where they're just like, bam, that's the movie we're making. And you go, oh, right. We're doing it your way then. Right. And as most of Poor Things, that's what it's saying and doing through its writing and acting. It's a little disappointing that the surface nature of the design is,
right.
is a little bit.
However, at the same time, they tried to make some really grandiose art direction statements.
Yeah, but they kind of, yeah, this is kind
they
of
fumbled it.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah. It's, yeah, I agree.
Like I was saying earlier, I think he's one of my favorite directors. He took on something that had too much visual language that he didn't understand.
Right.
And he relied on others.
Right.
Too much. Right. To help drive it along. Mm-hmm. And that's why I think some of those choices, like the lensing and everything, fell to the wayside because maybe he wasn't sure visually about things.
Yep.
And that's the thing about it. I thought while watching this for the first time that this would make a great movie. No, when I was watching it for the first time, I was like, imagine if she played a woman her age, same woman. I know this is based on a book, but she was in a coma for a while. And then she comes out of the coma and goes through the same storylines, you know, like her father's maybe a doctor or something. But
the
point is that same exploration, but in a contemporary world or even in the 70s, but contemporary world. Not fantasy, no steampunk.
Oh, interesting, yeah. Right.
You know what I mean? Like Detroit, 1978.
Right.
How would that be perceived?
Which actually verges on a little Swiss Army Man right there, what you're saying. Like the Swiss Army Man, we won't talk about it yet, but like there's much of that sort of like, there's the absolute fantasy nature of the world, and you get a little bit of a glimpse into the reality of the situation.
See, I saw this, I hadn't seen Swiss Army Man. Mm-hmm. And about the beginning of the third act, I said, is this what's happening to Paul Dano? Is that did he die of a heroin overdose? And this is his fantasy. This is what came through his mind before he died of an overdose from heroin.
I think it's something like that. There's some,
really?
We'll get to that part.
Like,
but it's
like
interesting.
A guy
yeah.
who took overdose on drugs,
mm-hmm.
and he's got these things that he hasn't completed in his life.
Right.
And bothered him in that subconscious,
yeah.
coming through in a kind of narrative fashion.
Yeah. I feel that some version of that is probably their intention. We'll get to it, but like that movie is about a person. There's not two people in that movie.
No, it's one person.
No, it's one person.
Right. And so that's the core of that. But without going into that movie, I think that's a very interesting observation. And I think that like with your idea for Poor Things, I mean, like you kind of want something like that where you just go like, this whole world is like she is really in command in her mind. And now do the Barbie thing of saying, can you translate that to the actual world that you lived in, that you're a part of? And which is the thing that I think they did right in Barbie is to lead up to that idea. Like we can come up with all the answers in an intellectual way, but in the end, you have to port that to the real world, and that might have been very interesting for Poor Things to dabble in. Like I think it's interesting.
By the way, just for everybody in Twitch, I put the link to my Pinterest, and there's a great section called Carolyn Vreeland. Please check it out. Great
right
actress.
Excellent.
I don't
Excellent.
Know if she's acted before, but she's a great actress. And
beautiful. I don't know if she's acted before, but yeah, she's
I
clearly
wonderful. All the time.
I'm wondering, yeah, just put that in context. But
yeah,
very while we're not trying, while we're talking about a movie that does not objectify women, let's talk about Carolyn Vreeland and how Eric.
Carolyn Vreeland is. I sketch her. I love sketching her.
Yeah,
she is like perfect.
Beautiful people are beautiful people, man. I don't think that anyone should be ashamed of that.
Yeah.
Like, no, she just has a great, like, you just want to paint and draw.
Yeah. I think that's
other
I
things,
think
but
that's absolutely fair game. You know, it's like, you know, like, it's not like you don't want to objectify Brad Pitt in Fight Club. That's
but
kind of the point. Like, and you see him with his shirt off in Fight Club and you go, that dude looks good.
That's like, so funny you say
pretty
that.
Pretty good.
I read this article and it was an interview with. The woman, the actress that plays, that is Elvira.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, right. Yeah.
Right. And she actually lived next door to Brad Pitt. She actually, he moved out. I think, I know exactly where she was. It's by the Ralphs up by the Scientology Center up there. It was Jimi Hendrix's property. He bought it all. But when he was training for, she was saying when he was training for Fight Club, he would train in his garage, would keep the door open with a boxing bag and do training. And he would just be shirtless. And she would walk by with her dog or her friend, and they would just stand outside.
Like, holy shit, look at that dude.
He's so beautiful. And she and my friend would meet for coffee. Yeah. Then we'd just walk and hang out and just watch him work out.
Yeah, right on, man. I endorse that wholesale. Like,
he's a sweetheart. He's a really amazing person.
Yeah, I think that's a great example, because like the thing is like the two about like beautiful movie stars, like I think it's when people complain about that fact, I think it's silly, because the reason why you want beautiful people up on the screen is, first of all, they're beautiful and it's lovely to look at beautiful people like Brad Pitt. Secondarily, most of the time, these people are for you to project into to an extent, you know? And so Cary Grant is a fucking super stylish, sick, clever motherfucker because I want to feel that way. I want to identify with this guy, and he's my best self up on the screen. Imagine if I were that witty with Ava Marie Saint. My God. Imagine if I wore a suit like that, or if I was that tan. Like, that's incredible.
That black and white. Yeah. So, yes, very tan.
highly tan.
Highly
super
tan.
Super tan.
Super tan, yeah. What's his name? George Hamilton, right?
Yeah,
But so at one point, she basically, he thinks he's controlling her through sex, but she's really just doing whatever the hell she wants.
Exactly.
He tries to take her out on social occasions, showing her off because she's really hot, but she does whatever the hell she wants and is rude at the table because
like
she's
pretty
a child.
Woman, wasn't that?
Yeah, a little
like,
pretty
right,
woman.
Exactly.
Except Pretty Woman felt bad about herself. She doesn't feel bad about herself at all. She wants to go punch a baby because it's crying and disturbing her meal.
Yes,
right?
Exactly.
And their whole dance sequence they did was amazing.
Oh yeah, she's just like she just rules the floor. And even when he tries to dance with her, she's like overpowering him.
Right.
Yeah. It's just great fun.
And so he's like fine, and so he like takes her away to some other place because he has no control over her, hoping that putting her back on the boat and confining her is going to
prisoner
her.
Exactly. And she recognizes it immediately.
Yeah,
like she trusts him for 1 second, like, oh, get in this box, and then it'll be a great surprise. She gets out of the box. She's like, "Where I'm on a boat because you want to trap me here." And you're like, "Oh man,
right?
She's fast. She's pretty fast."
Yep. But then she ends up finding this older woman and this man. So tell a story about that. Someone. What about the older woman and the man?
Yeah, the old reading woman and the young man who is a nihilist.
Who's a nihilist, right? But he tries to manipulate her too.
Yeah, exactly. Like he's the most gentle about it, but he even admits, like, I wanted you to feel this way, and that's why I did these things.
Right.
Like, and so you see that the movie is constantly both identifying these flaws in people, largely guys. But then it's very, instead of just like shredding them, like, aren't guys assholes? It's like, this guy sees that he was wrong and there's a chance that he might stop being a douchebag. Whereas like Mark Ruffalo, like, you constantly want him to be a better person and he keeps failing. But like, it's not outright.
He's
so pathetic. He keeps on going back to this story that he wants to be living. And she says it. Yeah, you're exactly right, Eric. Like, she ends up saying, like, you're a little child. Like, I'm not afraid of you. You're a little child.
Yep.
You know, and which is the basic problem for many, many guys. And most guys don't get out of that trap. But at least the movie is like, doesn't say that this is blanket statement the way that men are. They're useless and stupid and they should be shut down. It goes like, this is a very common flaw with guys, and they try to rope you into this bullshit because of their own ego problems. Don't buy it. It's their problem. That is their problem. You know, and I think that's a healthy way to look at it. It's still very empathic towards other people with problems without trying to blame them for your situation. And I think that's responsible.
Yes.
Like they're the ones, they're fucking up their own lives. You don't have to partake in that.
But there's something about the way that that guy sense is shoving his reality onto her to power over her.
Yeah, because he doesn't want, he sees this, the clarity with which she sees things, and that frightens him because he doesn't want to have hope in the world.
Right.
It's safer to have no hope for him.
Right. So she, the way he does it is she has a very privileged life, as you can imagine, a lot of money living in these, and it's, you know, Victorian era, whatever, fantasy land, but she has, you know, lots of money, et cetera. And he introduces to her extreme poverty and look at how horrible life is to all these
people. She's an empathic person. She's very sad about this when she sees people.
So she steals all of Mark Ruffalo's money and gives it all to the poor.
Or
she gives it to people, trusting that they will give it to the poor.
Right.
And they immediately just take her money, and he's like, and I gave it all to the poor.
Right.
And Mark Ruffalo's like, what the fuck? That's all my money.
Yeah.
So they end up lost in Paris.
Right.
And she's like, we need to make money. I was like, okay. Ah, I know how I can make money. Prostitution.
Yeah, let's talk about you guys. Let's all become part of this, you know, this brothel, and make some cash this way. And she looks at it as this way to observe more aspects of
life,
people's flaws, and, you know, like, what are the things that she likes? What are the things she doesn't like? What are the things that are sad? You know, and like, this is a cross section of a cross section of life in this, you know, through this particular lens, and she comes at everybody, even like the scummiest guys. She's like, well, he's broken in this way, and this is kind of sad, but this is kind of fun. And I'm like, when's the last time you heard anybody talk about anything? Like, this has not been done in a film in, since the 70s, as far as I'm concerned.
Right.
Like, where it's just like that very matter of fact and honest views of sex and these people that she meets and all this stuff. And, like, sometimes it's fun for her, sometimes it's boring, you know, sometimes the guys are gross, sometimes the guys, I mean, just, like, this is the people you will meet in the world.
At what point do you think it switched from being naive to revengeful?
I don't think, well, revengeful at the end.
At the very end, yeah. Like,
but it just didn't come, meaning she knew his state, and she was kind of
Ruffalo's state.
Yeah, but as soon as she on the street says, you know, fuck off in a way, she basically, it's like she knew her tools.
Well, she's she like at do. That point, she really sees that this dude is not, like, she had modest hope that he would get his act together because he's good at sex and he's not unpleasant to be around when he's happy. But he just reaches a point where he just won't let go of his bullshit story. And she's like, ah, fuck off. Done with that.
No, but what I'm saying is, like, there's a revengefulness of her knowing her power. And she kind of, there was a point where it started to show up because it shows up at the end.
Well, it definitely shows up with her actual former husband. Like, although that's the way I took that, but was
why?
Like,
he was the most innocent.
Not the nice guy husband.
Not the fiance.
Her body's husband.
Her body's old husband. We'll get to that at the end, yeah.
Right. And so, like, I don't feel that she was so much vengeful as just sort of exhausted. You know, she's just like, enough of this fucking junk.
Yeah.
Like, why do you have to keep on playing the same old song? Like, why can't you grow up?
Well, yes. And he gets, he's very funny.
God, when he's out going, Bella, you know, like, you know, Marlon Brando style, you know, Speaker of Desire. And, like, he's just so ridiculous. Like, he's just so perfect.
He's also in the asylum or whatever he is, where he's just like,
don't you understand? The problem is her. It's like, oh, man.
What a pussy. I mean, honestly.
Like, the thing is, like,
beautiful.
Yeah, this is what's
first
great
of
about
all,
it,
I gotta applaud him because he's such a talented actor, and he's been stuck in the the Hulk character for too long.
It must be extremely refreshing to be doing something else with his time. Yeah. I'm glad he made all that money. God bless him. Good choices. But man, like, that must be like sitting free. Yeah, I get to go out in the prison yard. Fantastic.
Yeah,
I get to go out in the prison yard.
But yeah, he's obviously having a blast. And like, the thing is, like, the reason why I find this so funny is that I've been this kind of idiot before. Like, I've totally been this douchebag. You know, it's not like I'm not like, haha, look at that asshole. I'd never be that way. I'm like, I've been exactly this asshole.
I've never had the confidence that he had, at least in the beginning of the movie, to be able to do it.
I've not been the best of people in my life, and to see something
you've
like
said
this
that before. I have trouble believing that, but
I'm glad you have trouble. I'm glad I'm at least operating that well. But like, I see a person like Ruffalo, I'm glad that they have so much empathy towards him, because I think that people can get out of that kind of negative loop, but many people don't, it's just a thing you see, and it's sad. And
were you a good person, Chris, or a bad person 20 years ago?
Oh, I was all over the place.
Yeah, I think
I'm
all
better
over the
now
place
than
is the better
been,
way
I think
it. yeah
I mean, I don't know, I think it's like all phases in life, right? The minute you get good at the phase you're in, it's time to get to the next one, so
I
you
know.
Never get
that's how it is. Everyone's been a fucking jerk at some point in their life.
Oh, absolutely.
That's how it is, you know. And you try not to be, you know.
Oh, I have just constant nightmares of things I've said in the past and just shiver. And doesn't everyone do it? If someone says they've have any regrets, then they're clinically narcissistic.
Yeah, it's just not true. It's just not right? true. Some like, you say, don't want regrets
I've
to
been,
control
you know,
your life.
Some say I'm the best podcast host ever to live on the planet of this.
Yeah, come on.
Yeah, like, you know.
Like I think it's, like, you shouldn't spend too much time being regretful, because you're no longer that person, and you don't want to keep on doing that, so let it go. But like,
speaking of that.
But learn from it.
I mean, I just don't understand, you know, I hate to say this, but when I watch Trump talk about things, he's like, I'm the best ever. And he does it every 5 seconds.
Yeah.
Right.
It's embarrassing. That's
but I just wonder, how do his supporters see that and not go, what the fuck is wrong with him?
They don't, because to bring up the Hollywood, the handsome star of the movie, like, when you're projecting, when you're looking up at the movie screen, right? You're watching a heroic story. You want to identify with someone is up there portraying the best parts of what you believe. Like, they're not a real person. Like, that's a character.
I understand, right? But and that's so not that's a what good he, person. What you're saying?
No, I know, but that's like this. Like, their point of view is like, this guy is saying the things that I wish I could say. He's doing the things I wish I had that confidence. You know. Like, from my point of view, then, like, this is an example.
Do they really believe? It was like, you're right. You are the best person that ever has been around.
I think that you respond to confidence that way. I think everyone responds to confidence.
I'm not going to go down. But he was created by the Democrats.
Absolutely.
He certainly reinforced all the time.
Did not say, talk about deplorables.
Yeah.
There are so many people that need help, that don't have the education to advance and have had real hardships. And so they cling onto a knucklehead like that because that's all they got.
The thing is, like, I think that guy, and I despise him as a, like, I don't know him, but I despise what he does. Right. And so he might be
relating this
guy,
back to Ruffalo's character.
Yeah. Yeah. So like someone like this, you know, like the reason why they like, they control people with their faults, you know. So if someone is self-conscious, you prey on their self-consciousness and you manipulate them. Or for instance, with Trump, like, not only does he like he plays to his supporters and like it acts like I'm the great guy and you should be proud of being a blah 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 whatever it is, but his real power is making us mad, because then we treat his constituency poorly, and that makes them want a hero to support them even more.
That's right.
Like, he manipulates, his biggest manipulation is the Democrats.
Yes, by us responding and us making all
the way
the
that
mean,
we respond empowers him constantly. Yes, yeah, and he depends on it, right? So this is the with it.
So by just being even more of a crazy fuck, Yeah. He actually makes it easier for the other people.
Right. Because the people are being treated, because the Democrats treat, people like assholes, deplorables, whatever. Like, they feel even more put upon and et cetera, et cetera. And then they respond even more to Trump's pride and ego, standing in for what they have lost. Like, right. That's on us. That's just on us. You know, and we give into it every day. And I'm constantly amazed with this election cycle. Like, oh my God, what can we do to win? We're going to lose. And I was like, well, you could try to convince people to vote for our guy.
Yeah. How about talking about,
that?
How about some issues and talking to what people really
How about listening to people? Yeah, exactly. Yeah. You know, how about being empathic? But anyway, with Ruffalo, that's the thing. It's like Ruffalo is like his set of tricks works on normal people. Because normal people everyone has tremendous ego issues. And Ruffalo strolls in. He's like, I'm the best at sex and dancing, and I know all the places in Lisbon and blah, 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 blah. And if you have a weak ego, you're like, oh my God, he knows so much more than I do. This is great. I need to hang around this guy.
Because she's a child, he thinks he can manipulate her, but nope.
But it's not true. And that's why the longer it goes on, the more she grows, like the more experience she has, the more control she has, and her will never changes. And so he is weaker and weaker and weaker because he never had this power over her to begin with. The only power he had over her was knowledge. Mm-hmm. And eventually she just knows more than him and he's out of business.
Yeah. Okay. Where were we? She adventures in prostitution, ends up going back to London, right? I don't know if I forgot something, but she ends up discovering that she was, in fact, her brain comes from her own child.
Right.
Oh, right. Her father, God. Mm-hmm. I love the fact that her name of her father is God.
Yeah. God said this, and then God said this, and God created me.
God. Yeah.
Right.
Kind of very, I mean, it's not so subtle metaphor.
It's but not. I like unsubtle stuff.
Yeah.
You do it right.
Pretty hilarious.
Great. Yeah.
But he's dying. God is dying. Also good. Tries to operate on his own tumor. Pretty hilarious as well. But she discovers her own origin, which is she is born from her own child. At which point, throughout we've been hinting, she is recognized by some people in her journeys, and they realize that she is actually someone else.
Right.
And so she was a woman who was pregnant and committed suicide. And the reason she committed suicide is she was in a horrible marriage.
Right. She essentially fell prey to a much worse version of Mark Ruffalo.
Like a
psychotic version.
Sadistic.
Sadistic, psychotic version. Right.
Yes. Literally psychotic.
Completely unempathic version of this.
Right. Film producer.
Right. Film producer.
Yeah. Right. Yeah. So, Harvey Weinstein. Right.
Yes.
Did you see that story I sent out about Dogma?
No. Oh yeah, oh, god damn, that's horrible. Yeah. He had to sell it to Weinstein.
Interesting. It was because Miramax owned all of the films that Kevin Smith did, right?
Right.
So Kevin Smith did all these films, Miramax owned a bunch of them, and then Disney bought all of Miramax, but they wanted nothing to do with Dogma because it was too controversial religion, right?
Mm-hmm. Right.
And so Harvey Weinstein just bought it himself.
Yeah.
And then he owns it and Kevin Smith can't do anything about it, which is weird. But it is on YouTube.
Drag. Yeah.
The whole movie is on YouTube.
Highly recommend. I love Kevin Smith as a personality. Like, I love hearing him talk about movie making. I think he's wonderful. I've gone to see him a couple of times for this. I'm not a big fan of his movies.
Like, nor am I.
Yeah. No. Like, I mean, it's just like,
Some of his movies I like. I liked Chasing Amy.
Yeah, it's good. Like, I like these. I mean, I like them, but I'm not over the moon. But like, actually, the movies that I love from him are his horror movies. I think he's actually a great horror director. I wish he would make more of those. Those are much more interesting to me.
Dogma
is genuinely, that for me is the best of his old material. Like, I'm just like, he really has an opinion here that he wants to deliver, and it's really
funny as hell.
Like, that's a really good movie.
Yeah, if you're going to make a movie,
it's
about
offensive. It goes for the throat, and it's very, very light about it. It's really, really great. Really fun movie.
And what's his name plays to Angel?
No, it's got Affleck, and it's got
Angel.
Morissette. Yeah, yeah.
No, the Angel. The Angel.
Hang on.
Gabriel is played by who died. He was Snape in Harry Potter.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, that's right. Alec. He talks like this.
Come on. Someone on chat will know.
Is he a big fish?
No.
No, he's diehard villain.
Diehard villain. Yes. Good diehard. Come on. Someone in chat. Respond.
Because
I can't do much on my computer. It's a long
Alan
story.
Rickman. Alan Rickman.
Alan Rickman. Thank you.
God damn it. Oh, yeah, yeah.
Oh, my God.
Wait till you turn 50, boys. That's what I got to tell you. Anyone listening? You wondering why we're crazy? That's what happened.
Right.
Randomly disconnected neurons.
Alan Rickman. But anyway, where were we? Okay, so she finds out that her husband, and then she goes back to her husband.
Yeah.
Or takes her.
And no,
she voluntarily goes back.
Yeah, she wants to find out.
What's this all about?
I want to know what this is all about. Yeah.
Which I thought was amazing because you could tell right away that he's a horrible person.
Instantly.
And then when she goes back, you're like, why would you voluntarily go back? And you're like, wait, throughout this whole movie, she's like, I want to see what that's all about.
Yeah, I just want to see. I'm curious. Like, she's constantly curious, even about bad things. You know, and he instantly explains himself, basically saying, I am a sociopathic narcissist and I'm going to control your life. And she's like, no.
Yeah.
I don't think that's going to happen.
And Shane's here. Hey, Shane Mullins.
Shane, good to see
you. Yeah. So that guy is, oof.
Yeah. I mean, and he's like, and the thing is like,
but she has so much, like, it's so funny because his whole thing is controlling and being evil to people, including her. And she just deceives him so easily.
He's a dimwit. He's a dumbass, you know,
so like, easily.
Yeah. And the thing is what's sort of great is that, like, you know, it's the most, like, you know, we're talking, it's the most vengeful part of the movie, but really it's not, it wasn't even vengeful. It's just like, what do you fucking do with this? Like, you can't do anything with this guy. Like, it's not like you can do anything else. Like, you're not going to make him into a better person. Like, it's not your responsibility. He's just a monster. And that's it. And the thing is, like, I think that this movie earns this character because it has a much more even-handed view of all of the other characters it's criticized. And then it just goes, in the extremity, we have Donald Trump. You know? And that's it. Like, when you get a guy like this, he's just a monster. There's just nothing to be done. Whereas like other films are like, you know, all of the male characters are monsters and you cannot trust them all.
They're all really rich.
Right.
They're all rich, people.
Right.
They all are.
Oh, and, thanks to Shane Mullen for subscribing at tier one. Nice.
Thank you.
Much appreciated. But yeah, I think that's just a better way to do it. Even if you have a sort of a generally negative thing to say, like it's, this comes up a lot now. Do you guys, we talked about, a phrase I only just heard called steel manning versus straw manning. Like,
oh yeah. Explain this to,
we're probably
mansplaining it to all the people that know exactly.
I did not know this.
Maybe there are
other
idiots like us that don't know what this means.
I did not know about this, and I really like it. It's the, because. Like, for, you know, like there's the straw man argument, which is like you make it, you prop up a version of, say, whoever, Donald Trump, and you take
the straw man.
Yeah. Like you attack all the weakest parts of him so you can win the argument. Right. And, this
like
works.
Like his orange and his hair.
Right.
And
right. And like all this kind of stuff where it's
narcissism.
Just like, right. But that argument won't actually convince the people you need to convince, because they're already way beyond that. They've already bought into him, and this just sounds like, yeah, as a hero. So like,
makes you sound petty.
It makes you sound petty when you make a steel man argument instead of a strong man argument. Then you're going up against the toughest things for you to defeat and the best points he has, and if you can beat that, then you're really convincing someone. Like, that shows that you're thinking through your argument and you actually believe what you believe, and that what you have to say is valuable, rather than undercutting your own argument by taking the weakest fight. right? And I think that...
pointing out the weakest things of that character. Person.
Yes, exactly. And so, like, when I see something, and I don't want to pick on Barbie too much, but, like, to compare the two, Barbie is a bit of a straw man argument for me, and this is a steel man argument. Like, they're both saying a lot of the same things.
That's a good way to put it. And, but they're criticizing males.
Yeah.
Like, from a dip, yeah.
Yeah, like, I mean, I think
patriarchy.
It's funny.
Criticizing patriarchy from a different
point. Like, I think it's funny to make fun of guys wanting to, you know, like, play guitars and sing songs to get laid. Like, I think that's very funny. But it's also easy pickings, you know? like that you're not saying very much by making fun of that. Like, yes, yeah, we can all laugh at
those male characters were kind of comical in Portland.
Yeah, 100%. But they're also, yeah, like,
but
they're
so
like,
that's easy pickings too.
No, but it wasn't that cliche.
But the thing is, it was not cliche. No, it is. I'm agreeing with you, Eric. What is not easy is allowing them humanity and goodness and the ability to overcome their flaws like a human, which Barbie just flat out doesn't do. Like, they're just like, men are fucking idiots. And that's what it says.
He gets, his arc isn't bad.
It's not positive. Ken's arc is not a positive one. She's basically like, well, you got problems, Ken, and you get to go live on the beach. And you're like, well, okay. Like, seeing as though he was perfectly happy before he fucking met you. Like, I don't know if this is the best argument, you know. Or like, my biggest pick with Barbie is, like, it has things in it like all the Barbies are somehow, like, back in Barbie land, everything goes wrong because the men have supernatural powers of hypnotism that made the women stupid. I'm like, what does that connect to metaphorically in the real world? What are you saying? Do men have magic powers? No. Like, could it be partially your codependency with these similarly weak people that is creating a problem between the two of you? Yes. But does the movie take responsibility for that? No. Whereas Poor Things does. Poor Things is like, is this my problem or is this your problem? This is your problem, so I'm not going to get tangled up with you on this. And if I do get tangled up, that is my thing to work out and set myself free of. And that's something to admire. Whereas Barbie just essentially complains and then lets it sit there, which is fine to identify a problem, but it's not as much of a thoughtful home run as much of what Poor Things says. Mm. And I think that, like, what it does, especially with the male characters, is like, it has as much fun at the expense of its male characters as Barbie does, but also goes, they are humans with problems that they need to solve for themselves. And sometimes they can, and sometimes they can't. Like, and so sometimes these are good people, but it's not like a genetic problem that they are bad and they don't have magic powers over me. And so, like, that's why I think this is a responsible film, whereas Barbie's the less responsible.
Paper thin is just as much as...
Oh, well, I completely agree with you. But you see what I'm saying is like...
But they also create her fiance
Chris,
who's...
Just,
go ahead.
To clarify for Eric, like, what I'm picking on isn't the fact that they are paper thin cartoon characters, right? When they make fun of them, like, look at how ridiculous Ruffalo is, the same way I look at how ridiculous Ken is, right? But by and large, Barbie does not afford its male characters any agency or humanity. It doesn't have to. It's not, you know, like, it doesn't have to do that. But
they do for Ken, to an extent. Yes, but the movie's called Barbie.
Yeah, but the movie about this, like, Poor Things is about Emma Stone, and it makes it all about her and her decisions and her taking responsibility for her life. And it mocks the male characters to an extent, but it also allows them.
Is she alive? Is she real?
I don't know. But I mean, as a story, like, in regards to how it treats its, the things that it's criticizing in men are both accurate and empathic, as opposed to Barbie. They're just like, these idiots like music I don't like. And that's the joke.
Okay, I get it.
That's where it's weak.
But I still think, you know, maybe you're doing that straw man thing where it's like comparing it to Barbie.
Fair point.
You know, it's like...
Yeah, you're exactly right. And I don't mean to pig pile on Barbie. There's lots of things I like. Yeah, I'm just saying, like, if I were to weigh these two things, one works better for me than the other. I'm not trying
but those are totally different tonal in movies. One is
an artist
making a movie on his own, based on a book, on his own kind of
100%.
And the other is dealing with a corporate product.
Yeah.
And you know,
like I'm only using Poor Things as a contrast to say, like, here's where I think that Barbie had within its reach a more poignant and useful thing to say, and it chose not to say it. So I don't like it as much.
She possibly shot for it.
I think that's her intention. 100%.
You know, it was a committee,
but
just
totally.
In terms of the characters in Poor Things, I felt like there was the male characters were almost intentionally pulled back. I mean, they just made them, you know, like childlike and spoiled rich brats. And I didn't feel like that was helped her character become stronger. I mean, she got her strength from the women.
For instance, like, I think that in Poor Things, the thing that really makes the argument best for me in Poor Things is Willem Dafoe's character. We haven't really talked about very much, but I like that he is a very flawed, broken person. But his attitude towards this is just sort of blasé. Like, he doesn't, like, he never makes his problems her problems, even though he has been obviously treated extremely badly, you know?
And
he's been tortured by his father, right?
Mm-hmm.
And like, sometimes you're like, does he recognize that this is bad? Like, what? He's obviously fucked up by this, but at no point does he even consider,
he doesn't seem to have empathy at all, yet somehow he's kind, which is weird.
He does have empathy, but he's
committed to his craft.
Yes, exactly.
And
exactly.
So his craft takes precedence over this, his emotions as what he dealt with.
Right. And so, like, he is sort of incapable of making the leap that she does as a human. However, at least he's living according to a set of rules in his mind that prevents him from abusing her or abusing his relationship with people. Like, he's like, well, that's how it is, and just sort of plods along with his life. And so it's like he's the sort of base routine of being a decent person, not even a good person, just a functional decent person. And I think that she builds off of that. Like, that's the baseline, and then she grows from there. And like, nobody else in the movie, like none of the other guys in the movie, I would argue, even reach his level. Like, they don't get to the point where they're as open-minded and, selfless as he can often be. Even though it's not very much. But by including him, it justifies their argument against the other guys. I think that's well-rounded and thoughtful. And that's why I appreciate the movie.
Did you think it was a little bit too long?
Mm-hmm. I did. I think that it makes the same point many times in many clever ways. It didn't need to do it as many times as it did.
I agree.
No.
I agree.
They cut 15 off. I think it'd be perfect.
I think you're right.
But just to sum up the ending of the movie, basically she gets away from her horrible husband, but then she traps him and turns him into a goat. Right? Goat? Is it a goat?
Yeah. Swaps his brain with a goat brain.
Right, a goat brain, and he's like a goat man walking around.
Right.
And, you know, her father dies, and she basically controls the life, and she has lives with her fiancé and her friend, who's the other girl. Oh, right. Her father makes another one.
Oh, yes. Yeah, right. Assembles we won't have the problems that the first one had, and just makes her kind of mindless.
Mindless.
I know.
Yeah. And that's, what's her name?
Margot Qualley.
Margot
Qualley. Andy McDowell's daughter.
Yeah.
Is that who it is?
I love her. I think she's terrific.
She's great.
Yeah.
She was good. She's really good in,
Once Upon a Time in Hollywood.
Once Upon a Time. She's terrific.
She's good in Once Upon a Time, but she's in the series, the Leftovers.
Oh, yeah, I still have never seen The Leftovers. I'm told that would be great.
Yeah, first couple seasons, really good.
Yeah, it's awesome.
Really good. She's good in that, too.
She's also, for video game fans, she is a major character in Death Stranding, and she's terrific in that thing. For folks out there that know that video games can be emotional, Death Stranding, she's great.
Yeah. Okay, so that's basically how it ends. She's like, all right, I got to do my thing. I got, you know, control over my life, and that's the end of the movie.
Yep.
Which is a little bit of a happy ending for a Yorgos Lanthimos movie.
It's true. And I'll be honest, like, I think they kind of fumble the husband story a little bit. Mm-hmm. Like, they don't pull that off. I think this is where it got, where if it's too long, is that that's the one story where that I don't, like, it kind of fails its own point in the way that it works. Because I feel like she should... That going back there should be a comparison to the person that she was, you know, so you see who she is now versus who she was then. So she really has something to let go of.
Right. Yeah.
And they don't do that for some reason, which I thought was sort of weird. I thought, like, what, I'm not sure why you have this happen if that's not what you're going to do. Instead they just have like, here's another douchebag guy. And I'm just like, yeah, we did that one. Like, this is the most extreme edition of it, but it doesn't, I'm not getting any extra meat off the bun from this. You know,
well, I think they're trying to, like, whatever happened to this, her life in the past, and they needed to somehow wrap that up. And why did she commit suicide?
Yeah, to see who she was in comparison to who she is, right, that's the synthesis of the statement. Right. And so, like, what they come up with the thesis, and then they come up with the antithesis, and then they don't do the synthesis. You know, they fail in that last note. And so I think that's where I was like, oh, the movie just kind of ended, and it's fine, and it's kind of funny. But, you know, like I said, this is all essentially my problem with Barbie as well. They both fail at the same point. Like, bring it all together into a statement, please.
Maybe that's the problem. No one knows what the statement is anymore.
Yeah, they didn't. Yeah, like, I think that this came pretty close and then didn't seal the deal.
That's right.
Well, I will say that. Yeah, go ahead, Eric.
Was that scene when she got back, Dan, and she's having that walk, but it looks Victorian, old Doug Arrow type,
yeah, right,
and great color, and he's her husband, the nice husband,
yeah,
is who used to be the assistant
with
to
the Russian
father.
Lens that they use.
Yeah, right, yes, right, right.
They're walking. That was Annie Hall.
It's 100%.
Oh, yeah, totally.
Absolutely. 100%. Absolutely.
Right?
Yep. Yep. 100%. Yeah.
But it's also like, that was the most luxury part of the movie to me.
Yeah. But she kisses him. He kisses her. She's like, we're not going to do that, but we'll do something else. Just like in Annie Hall, he's just like, kiss now. We'll digest better.
We'll digest better.
Yeah, right.
That's right, right.
But it's the one that's the most luxury is like, you see, he treats her with respect, and that's how you should treat people. It's too much.
Yeah, she won't have sex with him.
Yeah, I think that's right.
So he is. Here's the thing: he's a guy who's saying, "I really respect you," but she's like, "Yeah, I love being around you, but we can't have sex."
Yeah,
I don't want to have sex with you. So if you're nice, you're not gonna get action.
Yeah, like I don't respect his character. At all.
Neither does she, really.
And I was just like, I don't know what his, I'm not sure what his, because he doesn't change almost at all in the movie. And I feel like he should have changed in a way that bounced off of her more in the end. But they both fail, like both characters don't sum up their own stories very well. And then they don't sum up a story together enough to justify that scene.
If you wanted to compress it, let's just say we compress it. Ruffalo should have been the huckster who gets the job to be her assistant.
Yeah.
Then he steals
right, sure,
her to run away.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah, that's a good point. That's a good point. Yeah. Yeah. Just like tighten it up. Tighten it up. I agree. I totally agree. Yeah. I think that there's like, so like, as you know, like, I think that this movie is very, very good and I liked it a lot. You know, it's on the upper end of the Best Picture nominees for me. Like, I was like, I enjoyed that. That was really good. And I like Emma Stone a lot. I like what it's saying. It's good. It's a good movie. But it's not like, you know, almost none of the movies I saw on this list were like the the home runs that people are trying to sell me on them as being. Like, they're all pretty good or not that great. I'm just
you didn't
high
like
energy
Oscars
for me.
Say
again?
You didn't like Scorsese.
I was bored out of my mind with that movie. That was a very boring movie. And I love Scorsese. Like, that was a dull movie. I like The Irishman, and it was boring.
I didn't see it. I don't. Really, I mean, if Daniel
like,
finds
it
boring,
was like getting
that's
catheter'd.
Gonna be, yeah. Which one?
The Irishman.
Yeah, like this is far, far more dull than The Irishman. The Irishman is a coherent statement, but slow. This one is like, I don't know what the fuck this thing is doing.
Well, okay, so back, but I kind of disagree. While I do think there's flaws to Poor Things, I actually do feel that there is good out of this. Way better than I've seen.
Oh, it's a good, it's a very good movie. I liked it. I liked it a lot.
If I'm looking at this, I'm like, I am really glad a movie like this gets made. One,
absolutely.
Two, gets recognized as a good movie.
It'd be nice
if
it had more nudity, but yes.
If they could just get a few more frames, that'd be fantastic. Yeah. But I'm totally
like,
with you.
Oh,
I'm
my
totally
God. Like, thank you. Please make more shit like this and get
absolutely.
It recognized. And
absolutely. I mean, but for me, the gold standard with that was when Everything Everywhere won. I was like, that's a virtually flawless movie, and it's fucking crazy. It's great. Like, that is a 4-star event.
And speaking of those directors, our next film.
Hey, Eric, right, you are so good, my friend.
Perfect one. Nice.
That's very, very good. Okay, well, with that segue, I can't not go ahead. We're going to go on to this one.
Yeah.
Yes, which is our
Did I beat you to the punch on that segue?
You barely
did. I was almost there, and you just did it perfectly. I just handed
you
the segue, and you hopped
thing.
On with 2 feet and went.
You sounded like one of those Star Wars.
The Jetson car.
I was trying to do the sound of a Segway, which I really wish Segways did make that sound when you
I
go
know. Da, 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 da.
Is it true that the guy who invented the Segway fell off a cliff on a Segway?
Yes.
Is that real? Oh my God.
I think that is real.
It is real. Hoisted
on your own
if it's not, it's the urban legend that we all tell ourselves.
No, he died that way.
Yeah.
I have to step out for 1 second. I will be right back.
All right.
I think it was a kind of a mountain peak area in Massachusetts.
Mountain peak area in Massachusetts. Okay.
Or New Hampshire. I'm almost positive that, almost sure that that's how he died.
All right. I'm switching.
We should look it up.
Yeah. Okay.
Right?
Yeah. It could be. Someone could look it up and put it in chat. We're too busy podcasting. Okay. I
need answers now, Chris.
Okay. This movie came out in 2016, so it's actually freaking eight years old already.
So depressing.
Yeah. It cost $5 million to make the whole movie. And it's directed by the Daniels, who are the same guys who directed Everything Everywhere All at Once. And it's two main actors in this movie. It's basically a two-actor film.
Yes.
The whole film. Daniel Radcliffe plays a dead man, a dead body, the whole time, and it's amazing. And
you
I
love
just
this film.
I really enjoyed it. I know there's a lot of stuff to say. Yeah, okay, it's a little indie film, whatever. But films like this getting made just make me happy.
They made it for $3 million, I think. Something.
I think it was $5 million. But it was very little money. It might have been $1.5 million. I don't know what was the Swissarmy Man budget. I'm going to look it up actually real quick.
Look it up.
Swissarmy Man budget. Swissarmy Man budget is $3 million. You were correct. $3 million to make this movie.
Yep.
And there are significant amount of effects in it for that amount of money. Surprisingly. Really. Really, it comes off as a completely goofy movie, and then suddenly you realize, not suddenly, but you start to realize that it's a very, very sad film that you've been watching the whole time.
Yeah. People walked out of this.
Really?
Yeah, when it first came out.
Because of all the farting?
No, they didn't like the direction it was going. They just didn't understand it.
Yeah.
And so when they first showed it, I think it's South by Southwest or somewhere, it was just like, nah, the people were walking out of the theater, apparently. So I get it. The people just don't have patience for stuff like this, I guess. But yeah. I guess they do now because the same director's just won. Was something that some people, I guess if they put that out 10 years ago, people would have walked away. But these guys are very efficient filmmakers, and I think that's also one of the places that, you know, Hollywood is going. It's like these guys have a firm
efficient
command.
Filmmaking. Agree. And this, go back to the Oscars again, right? Daniel's back. Hold on a second. Go back to the Oscars again. If you look at this, the Oscars are all about efficient filmmaking. If you're looking at films that are being celebrated, things like Godzilla, The Creator. I'm talking about like visual effects right now.
Yeah.
And then this movie, Everything Everywhere All at Once. These are movies that are spectacular.
Yeah, the tide is turning. You know, it's really, really pretty great.
We're not sitting here with foie gras at craft services anymore.
Craft services. I think there's a direct relationship between your foie gras story and the fact that that is the only bad Coen Brothers movie.
Yes.
I think that is very true.
Just to give you...
You're right.
So to recount the story, I happened to be invited by a friend of mine to go on set for Lady Killers, which is a Coen Brothers film, the remake of the original film, which was a fantastic film starring Alec Guinness. But it was a remake by the Coen Brothers, and it's a completely forgotten movie by the Coen Brothers, probably by far their worst film.
Yeah, it should have been a softball for them. It should have been the easiest, you know.
It was terrible.
But it is a genuinely bad movie.
But I walked on set, and I was invited to go tour the set constructions, and I saw the building and the house and all this stuff, and it was cool to see all that stuff in construction. And they were saying, oh, we're having lunch. You should come by. You should have lunch. And it's just, you know, catered lunch as you do on set. I don't know if you know if you've had catered lunch, but it's like, you know, food. They put food on a table. You serve yourself on a plastic plate and lemonade, iced tea, whatever. But for lunch, it's like, oh, it's Friday, so we're going to do a little barbecue. And they had like Chateaubriand steaks and grilled prawns and like, what the fuck? And you know, when you have like a filet mignon and you're eating it on a Dixie Club plate with plastic knife.
Yep.
That's wild.
It's kind of weird.
That's kind of weird.
You know, it's kind of like,
that is kind of weird.
Oh, it's a barbecue. Barbecue is Chateaubriand steak? What the fuck? Right? And so it was a little bit, okay. So yeah, yes, like, that's gone.
Yeah, like that. I would say that they, like, I don't know what they were doing. Because that is the first movie they make after No Country for Old Men. Like,
oh, was isn't it that really? Wild?
Like, it's just like, yeah, they do No Country. It's like,
so they just were dialing it in.
They are just like, okay, because they do No Country for Old Men. Is no way, is it reversed? Maybe I'm reversed. No, I'm sorry. That's it. I've reversed it. It's the first movie they make after
Fargo.
They do Lebowski. Okay. So Lebowski, Oh Brother, Where Art Thou? Giant hit there with Oh Brother, right? They do The Man Who Wasn't There, which is pretty good.
Pretty but good.
Didn't make a lot of money, and then they do
Fargo,
Intolerable Cruelty, which is a very funny, sweet movie. It's a good movie. Mm-hmm. It's just not genius like the rest of their stuff. And then they hit Intolerable Cruelty, and like that's the bottom of the barrel. And you're like, have they lost it? And that is in, let's see, that is in 2004. They do a short film, Parachutem, but that, so 2004, and then they do No Country for Old Men. Like they made this movie.
They redeemed
like,
themselves.
They redeemed. They're just like, we fucked it up. We got lazy. We're eating Chateaubriand at the Crafty. Mm-hmm. We got our shit back together.
Mm-hmm. That was the same stages that we visited at the Amazon stages, by the way.
Oh,
that
really?
The same place I was.
Yep. Interesting.
Was it really?
Yeah, it was at Culver lot that I had that. Anyway, so, but this film is way more efficient and interesting. And it starts off and it looks like it's going to be a really stupid, goofy, absurd comedy.
And it is.
And it is.
However,
yeah. Yeah. And it starts off literally with a guy on a deserted island trying to hang himself unsuccessfully.
Right.
Many
Rope
times.
Breaks. Yeah, right.
And who's the guy who's the actor?
Paul Dano.
Paul Dano. Yes.
Yep.
Who also I saw recently in another movie called Dumb Money, which
is you said this good, yeah?
It was pretty interesting. Did you see it, Eric?
Yeah, on a plane.
Yeah.
I'd like to see that. That's about the GameStop stuff. Right?
GameStop.
Yeah, against hedge fund guys.
Yep.
Do you notice where it took place, Chris?
In Massachusetts. What?
No, the GameStop, they cut to the executives' homes, and it's in Connecticut and Greenwich.
What was that? Oh.
In GameStop, they're like, you know, they show exterior Greenwich, Connecticut, and it's all the hedge fund guys.
Right. That sounds good.
Yeah, well, that's what all those guys are. But anyway, so in this way, he's constantly trying to commit suicide, doesn't succeed. He is interrupted by a dead body that he sees on the beach.
Washes up on the beach, yeah. And played
by Daniel Radcliffe.
Harry Potter.
And this is something like Karen was like, first of all, I should say that the suggestion of, because we watched Poor Things and then we watched Swiss Army Man on a whim. And I was like, oh my God, this is hilarious. And he goes, this would be a perfect pairing for Poor Things. And I was like, actually, it's pretty good.
I'm going to lay my cards on the table. I saw Swiss Army Man. I didn't see it in the theater, but I saw it when it came out on video and I loved it. Like, I loved it. This is exactly my kind of indie film. Like
I love it because it's like, I just love that movies like this get made.
Yeah.
And that like, movies like this are possible.
This is a great indie first filmish kind of thing to have done. Where
and
it's
I
like,
just
it's
look at this
and
I project
kind of
my own, like if I'm going to make a movie, I want it to be like, if I make a first movie, this is the movie I'd kind of like to make.
Right.
And it's I wish
flawless,
I had the guts to, no.
It's great. It's great. It's a really, it's a really heartfelt swing at making exactly what you want to make.
Yeah.
Like it's nowhere near as good as like Everything Everywhere, but it's like, it is, well, it's, they're testing the ground to do that kind of stuff.
Yeah.
It's really,
but if you
really
don't, you make this one and you learn all the little things that you need to learn.
Yeah.
And then you get to the next one.
Brilliant. Really brilliant. And and I also want to applaud Daniel Radcliffe because like him and
just after he did his Harry Potter movie, he can do whatever the fuck
he
wants.
Whatever he wants, and he does
money, and it's good that he does that.
Yeah, it's amazing.
It's like, I'm going to play a dead body.
Shit. Yeah,
I'm going to play a dead body for an entire film.
Yeah, I'm going to put like or guns akimbo, or he's like, I'm going to have guns nailed to my hands. Yeah,
what is it? Breakfast at Bernie's or something?
Oh yeah, he does. it's Weekend at Bernie's. This is a very emotional Weekend at Bernie's movie.
This is a very emotional Weekend at Bernie's. Yes. So he finds this dead body on the beach. He can't seem to hang himself. Though it keeps getting interrupted because the body keeps farting.
Right. This is a persistent, I would say a pillar joke in this film.
This is taking the fart joke to the extreme. Yes. There is constant farting that's happening in this film. Yep. Because there is depressing. The minute something is very sad and depressing, it is interrupted by a fart.
Yes.
To take you out of that sadness.
Or a penis.
Or a penis.
Give it to me, man. This is what I want. This is what I want in my movies.
Yes.
Like, and I think that the symbol they're going with, right, is just like, there's this embarrassing stuff we keep inside, right? This shameful shame that we feel. And we can't let it out, or people will know that we're terrible people or whatever it is. And the movie is just like, what if instead we fart super loud?
Yeah.
And it is that unselfconsciousness that brings Paul Dano back to life.
Yep. It's the thing.
Yeah.
It's the thing that I think is awesome. It's like,
this is
oh
the connective
God,
tissue between
so
these
sad.
Two movies. Yeah.
What life is so sad?
Yeah, exactly. Like, don't get hung up on that story. Like,
it's the best.
It's so good.
And anything that can find a way to champion farting, I'm okay with.
No, 100%, man. Like, that's like, I think that this movie is, and there are movies in general, because I like what one of the things I loved best in Everything Everywhere is the plot where Michelle Yeoh doesn't want to tell her father that her daughter is gay, right? Because he won't understand. All right. This is torturing her daughter and making her life very hard. And in the end, he's fine with it. And Michelle Yeoh is the one who,
the
because
problem.
She was self-conscious, was making it hard. Like, she accepts it, but she doesn't trust other people. And so she is self-conscious.
You don't trust yourself.
Because you don't trust yourself. And it's like that's the kind of stuff. Like, like I always say, like the reason why good advice ends up on fortune cookies is because it's good advice. Like good advice is very simple. Like the real useful advice in your life, you can actually say in a sentence or two. But the reason why people hate it or they think it's cliche is because it's so hard to actually apply this stuff that they think it's not useful. When actually it's hard. It's just simple. You know? And I think that this is what what Swiss Army Man argues, essentially. It's like your pain is real, absolutely. And the way out of it is way easier than you, like it's simpler than you think. It's not easier. It's way, way simpler than you think.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that it's fairly elegant in doing that, as much as there is nothing but fart jokes.
Yes. So yes, man on a desert island tries to kill himself, finds farting corpse. Interrupted his own suicide because of the fart.
That's an elevator pitch if I ever heard one.
Right.
That is an elevator pitch if I ever heard one.
I mean, that is like, wait, what was this about? Man's trying to kill himself.
But they said it was a joke at first. Yeah,
I believe it.
Right.
That was a joke pitch.
I'm absolutely sure that's probably it was. But, and you know, sometimes those pitches are really good, right? Like, mm-hmm. like I remember Rory Robinson, right, when he was working, you know, he was joking with a bunch of friends about movies and he was saying, you know, a movie franchise is over when they go to space, right?
Right.
Right. So it's like, you know, oh, you know, you do Jason, you do Friday the 13th, whatever. And then like Jason in space, that's the end of the franchise, right?
You run out of ideas.
Right. And so they're like, so what other franchises could you do where you go to space? It's like, Jane Eyre in space, you know, in whatever, space, right. Whatever. And so he keeps doing, and so they kind of joked about this all the time. And they were joking about these movies, classic movies where they would take place in space instead. And then Rory said, okay, what about this one? Moby Dick in space. And then he's like, well, hold on.
That's Star Trek 2.
Well, yes, but he said, this would actually work. And that's when he came up with the Leviathan project. So he came up with Leviathan and it was like, it's essentially Moby Dick in space, right? They're farming these space whales. And then that's what it was, the whole pitch. And then he ended up getting a greenlit. It was, by the way, it's supposed to be made. It was optioned by Fox.
Oh my God. He should make
Neil Blomkamp was going to be executive producer on it, and then the whole Disney thing fucked it up.
Right. Who owns the rights to this thing now? Who owns the rights? This is a great idea. That should be made. What is he doing with it now?
I don't know. Can he do anything with it? Maybe he owns it again. I don't know.
If he owns it again, we should all talk because that's a great idea.
Yeah. You remember the short that he made?
The short is great. Yeah. It's incredible. It's a fantastic one.
Yeah.
Disney said no to it. Is that what, just to quickly?
No, Disney, when they acquired Fox, they just dumped they shed a bunch of stuff.
That's it.
Wes Ball was going to do the mouse thing that was really big. That got dropped. A bunch of movies got dropped when Disney bought Fox.
Right. Yeah, no, it's a disaster. That's all part of that's the same film struck nonsense that I always complain about.
Right.
The death of Filmstruck is like my JFK. Like, I'm just like, I can't stop thinking about how that changed the world.
Yeah.
Pacing around the house. But what if they did the refinancing of their bonds like this way?
I'm going to do my Oliver Stone on the death of Filmstruck. But yeah, I mean, go ahead.
Yeah. Okay, so where was I? So I'm lost a little bit, sorry. So he finds the body and then figures out that the body is farting so much farts coming out of the body that he can ride the body on the beach into the water like a jet ski.
Yeah, it's awesome. And he's so fucking psyched. Like, this is the best opening bit of, you know, just like, he's like,
He's riding a dead body.
If you don't like that opening gag, don't watch the rest of the movie.
Yeah. It's funny as hell.
It's exhilarating. It's exhilarating.
What's really amazing, you just got to realize, like, keep in context, this turns into a complete tragedy. This whole
it's a very sweet, sad movie. But it never stops being ridiculous.
But he was riding a dead man farting through the water like a jet ski.
Right. And he uses his penis as a compass.
As a compass.
As a compass.
It's hysterical. Yep. Like that is pure, beautiful absurdity. And it's so joyful. And this is the thing. It's like the movie itself is expressing the unselfconsciousness that it's advocating. Like it's absolutely. Just like, fuck it, let's go for it. And that's what's great.
Well, there's all the guy, our main character, is overcoming tons and tons of shame.
Yeah.
So much huge shame.
That is the centerpiece of Paul Dano's character.
Right. He is ashamed of all the things that he has done or created or wants or all these things.
Right.
And the dead body represents what if you didn't have shame?
Yeah.
Why?
Exactly. Yeah. He's
he's basically Emma Stone in a sense.
Yeah, right? Exactly. Exactly. Like, yeah, Daniel Radcliffe is Emma Stone in this movie. Like,
they're both dead. They're both dead people.
They're both dead people. But yeah, like Daniel Radcliffe is he's a dead character, but he is the spirit of life.
Oh, absolutely.
Know? And he is he energizes Paul Dano, over and over. Yeah, over and over again in the movie. And Paul Dano wants to fucking live on an island and kill himself. Like that's the opening gag.
Right.
And to see him slowly set himself free from that story is incredibly beautiful.
Yes. So he is, but the island he's on looks like a tropical island. Then
then Humboldt County.
Yeah, exactly. Right.
He goes into basically the redwood forests. Right. Mm-hmm. He's on the beach. He's like, oh, my God, I'm here.
As if Tahiti is right off of Seattle.
Right. Yes, exactly. Exactly. And then he's there, and he's trying to work through the forest to try to find civilization. He can't find it. He has a cell phone. That's right. That's another thing. He has a cell phone with 10% battery left, and he keeps checking it every now and then. You just see that battery just slowly. Yeah. Dying slowly, and the last glimmer of hope of him trying to connect with civilization.
Yep.
As he's trying to wave it around in he keeps it in this plastic bag. But he's trying to find civilization, and he's seen this redwood forest, and then he's dragging this dead body around with him. And then suddenly the dead body starts to speak to him as it's talking. Right. And he starts to achieve things. But then he finds all kinds of weird things that this body achieves for him. Like water.
Yeah, because he has all these weird sort of superpowers of the dead. You know, so you can bend his body in a weird way that makes him karate chop stuff.
Right.
You know, or like whatever. Like all these weird little gags that he does.
He's inundated with water. And then he realizes from his mouth he can get fresh water.
Right.
So he literally throws up fresh water. Yeah, right?
Exactly. So he can survive and drink.
So the whole point of him being called Swiss Army Man is that this dead body is like a Swiss Army knife of things that he can do.
All these things that help him survive.
Survive, right?
As he's lost.
And he's trying to find his way through the forest, which when you start to question it, because there's a whole bunch of trash. They run into a whole lot of trash.
Yeah. Right.
But is that forest a metaphor for trying to find his own identity as a person like she did?
Right. Well, I think it's a blend of, well, not to bury the lead. It's a blend of what is really happening for him, and a symbolic vision of his experience simultaneously. Cause I think that, we said before, these two people are the same person. And there's a lot of ways to read the movie, but that Daniel Radcliffe is, you know, there may be an actual dead body in reality. But Paul Dano is gone insane
It's basically the volleyball for Tom Hanks.
Yeah.
It's
the volleyball for Tom Hanks. Yeah. And so he is trying to, it's a metaphorical projection onto the landscape of him, his internal, working out of his own guilt and stress and shame, and he's externalizing it onto this dead body in fantastical ways, and that's more or less what is slowly revealed by the film. But even early on, you're like, so there's a tropical island, and this is obviously it makes these associations that sort of go outside the bounds of fantasy, and dabble in reality in ways that start to reveal itself.
Like, for example, I mean, right. Clearly, this is the nonsense, but you realize, like, there's trash everywhere near the beach, and somehow he can't find civilization because they're in the middle of nowhere. If they're in the middle of nowhere, there wouldn't be a bunch of trash.
There wouldn't be a bunch of trash. Right.
Right.
Like, this is some out-of-the-way place in a town.
Right. Right. This is where vagrants go.
Yeah, exactly. This guy's homeless and crazy. That's probably
what we find out in the end is actually what's going on.
Right.
Yeah, what's going on?
That he's probably a homeless and crazy person. Like, he's lost his mind from grief.
I thought
you have a great interpretation of this as well. I like this. This is
that
good.
He died of a heroin overdose. And there's something I felt about it. Like, it goes back to, all the music sounded like derivative of, the Beach Boys' Pet Sounds from 66.
Oh, yeah.
And I'm like, I had to like, kind of dig deep because I love Pet Sounds, but I'm wondering why, because that was a pivotal album because they produced it themselves and they use all these eclectic different vehicles to tell these stories. And I'm wondering.
I'm not a big Beach Boys fan. That is the one Beach Boys album that I'm like, that's a great album. That's a great weird album.
It's a great weird album, but they make great weird movies. And but it was very Beach Boys-y going through, but I felt like he was already dead.
I think that's a totally valid read.
He's totally just trying to encapsulate or go through everything that he did wrong because then he needs to go to the next level of wherever he's going in the afterlife, and that's where he goes off.
Yep.
And he was basically, you know, dead.
Yeah, can totally see that. Absolutely. Yeah, because, I mean, the movie is like, the movie never really, it never says what is happening. It's never absolutely literalizes the actual world, but you definitely know that there's, you know, whatever the metaphorical relationship is, like, the pain that he is dealing with is actual. Like, this is not rooted in being a fairy tale. Like, this is someone's actual experience only extrapolated as a fairy tale. And how it's connected to the real world is left sort of open-ended. But that's what also makes it sort of, you know, a very accurate simulation of that pain, because it's like, it's sort of unsolvable.
And you could be a dead person, but still convey that, you know, the lessons, and for the audience, like, you can, in a sense, like, it's not like they're using him as a vehicle as a dead person and keeping it mysterious. You still get the message across, and it's very heartfelt.
Yep.
Particularly in that bus scene I loved.
Yeah, that's great. That's great. Because, like, the combination of that and how he simulates the bus for Daniel Radcliffe, you know, when he constructs the
It's like, it just builds up so quickly and out of nowhere to a fantasy. Like, wait, what's going on?
Yeah,
and it's just beautiful. Just context of what it is. He's walking around with his man. He slowly discovers all these secret superpowers that Daniel Radcliffe has. The water one we described. He also finds out that our guy. In love with this woman who's on his phone, right?
Right.
A picture of her on the phone, and then when the dead body sees it, gets an erection.
Yeah, right.
And
then that becomes useful.
It becomes useful. The direction becomes the compass, right? Which is really funny. But they talk about things like, and all the shame that he has about masturbation. He talks about masturbation with the body. He's like, why don't you do it more? And it's like, wow, he's not supposed to do that. Oh,
that's supposed, that's bad. Yeah. That's
yeah.
Bad. Right.
And so there's all these things about shameful, et cetera, et cetera. And he goes through the whole process of learning and trying to, and so they seemingly make progress as they go. And they have this, it's a journey movie, right? They're going through his journey.
Right.
But one of the things they keep talking about is his girl that he meets. And he talks about how they met, or fantasizes about how they met and how he imagines her. And it's this thing that happens on a bus, right? And so he, by telling the story, he reenacts the story and constructs a bus
out of trash and sticks.
Out of trash and magazines. Sticks.
Yeah. Right.
And he has Daniel Radcliffe play himself, and he plays the girl.
Yeah.
To reenact, to
puts the coins in.
Yep.
He puts the coins in. It's just this crazy thing. And here, like, here's the scene in the bus that he does behind, Daniel now on the YouTube channel. But it's like, oh my God, look at that, you know?
Yeah.
And so, and like, and it's like this, this thing that they do. And it's just kind of this, this amazing story. And he creates, he constructs all these out of nothing, all these tools out of trash, this whole city.
And it's and really it's a beautiful, theater. Like,
it's a when theater. He's,
when Daniel Radcliffe is like supposedly on the bus, the trash version of the bus, and he's constructed this little like windy business with magazine covers to be the like it's like a scrolling set of pictures city. Going by. Yeah, exactly.
It's like a set from a play, right?
From a play, right? And he's just staring at the window. Like he's staring out the window at these at the landscape going by, and he's like. So that's the world. It's like, oh, it's amazing.
It's such a great, I mean, just.
It's, and it's so heartfelt. It's insane.
It's so great. So
I just wish that Poor Things, the message from this movie, I hadn't seen both of them. Mm-hmm. It really struck home more with the Dano film, Swiss Army.
Yeah,
than
it's a really
with Poor
movie.
Things. Because yeah, Poor Things had that setup and the ability to do that because the director's a genius. He really yeah, does. Right. But I think they over art directed and relied too much on other props. Like yep. I said, I'm not saying it. He's. Well, I'm saying, imagine if they put in 1978, a girl in Detroit.
Oh yeah.
House fire totally gets in a concussion, right. Gets out, and slowly has to, and then she does all that.
Right.
You there's something that you walk away with more from the Dano film in terms of learning human characters.
Completely agree. Like it's because yeah, but like Poor Things doesn't land the plane. Like it doesn't like this. Like, because ultimately the flaw in Poor Things is that she doesn't truly have, she doesn't face an internal challenge, right? She grows in terms of her experience, but she doesn't realize anything. And that's what makes the movie feel like it doesn't close well for me.
Right.
Is because I want people to, like, Paul Dano, like, this movie is telling a story about his soul coming back together.
Well, you know? The journey they're taking through the forest looks like it's miles and miles and miles and miles and miles. Right. Like, just like they're walking for like 100 miles right. And then suddenly get close to civilization, right? And then finally they get into civilization, right?
Yeah, it's just like this fucking
it's suburbia. Yeah.
Suburbia.
Right. Like, but they're yeah. right in front of the girl's house that he's obsessing about.
Yeah. Which means that they're probably really nearby all the time.
Right. And so she's like, what the fuck is going on?
Yeah.
Right?
These should have been famous by now. Mary Elizabeth Winstead, by the way, who right. I love and seems to resist being the superstar that she should be.
But yeah. And then everything starts to crumble. I mean, we're going straight to the end of the movie because I think we need to sort of get there to explain right. it. But everything starts to crumble. There's a relationship with his dad appears and apparently some strained relationship. Dad kind of walks away from him, right? You don't really quite understand what's going on. People want to take him away. He runs away and they race with him and realize they're probably about a quarter mile from the beach the whole time. At best, right?
The whole time.
They literally right. run after and chase him, and they see the bus. They see everything. Like, and you thought the bus was like 50 miles away. It was right next to them, yeah, right?
Right there.
All of this stuff. And they're like, oh, wait, what the hell is going on? And they're trying to control him because he's holding a dead body. He's still the yeah. dead. So the dead body is definitely there as
there
part of the
body.
Reality.
Yeah.
There is a body. So he clearly found a body. Right, and has been using it as a puppet.
Yeah,
the whole time
as the volleyball.
Like, as the volleyball, yeah, right?
Right.
And you're like, oh, that's really sad. And you start to realize, like, oh, it is very, very sad when you start to realize what's going on.
Yeah,
although you suspected the whole time, but
when the reality of it
crashes
lands.
In,
yeah, exactly. And the thing is, like, it never turns into real reality. It's still like. You know,
He farts his way away.
Like all yeah. that stuff. You know,
because there's like, oh no, it's a body. And the body goes and just farts like, itself away. Yeah.
To Eric's so I think your version thing is that, oh, I was going to say to Eric's version, like the way, like much of the interviewed by TV and all that stuff could still be his fantasy. Right. And he could be in the body bag, and the reason why his dad walks away is because he really is dying.
He was a drug addict.
Yeah, exactly.
And he died.
Yes,
that's the way I picked it up.
Yeah, it's absolutely interpretable that way.
Because also Pet Sounds, like the sloop John B. Good is like that story, that metaphor of getting away. I want to go home, but you can't.
Yeah.
I want to go home. Mm-hmm. Like he's so sick of where he is, but he can't. He's on his boat.
But it's sort of nice that they don't like lay anything out to literalize any of it. Like you're still like, wait a minute, is this real yet? Or is this not real? Some parts of this are real.
Have been nice if they had more product placements, but yes, it was a good film.
That's true. I always want a little Pizza Hut in my movies as much as I can. But yeah.
I don't really know if at that level of movie, I don't know if they really did much product placement except maybe like.
Yeah. I don't know if Pizza Hut would want too much to do with the farting dead boner body. That. Yeah. I think that's probably a step too far for even them.
Yeah, they did have a real Caesars. Bear.
Yeah, that's true.
They did get attacked by a bear.
Yep, good bear attack. That's fun. It's not quite the edge, but it's pretty good.
Yeah. The edge.
I love the edge. I love so the edge. But yeah, we should do the Edge. Yeah. Fucking great movie. Great movie.
But anyway, yes. So that's the sort of, and it's just kind of beautiful. I don't know. There's something about that movie to me celebrating its making, celebrating the fact that it's getting made.
But you also that love people, that type of environment. That's your type of world up there.
Yeah.
Oh, it's cool. Everything about it is, and the thing is, like,
it's a journey film. Journey films are my favorite.
Yeah. And like the making, like the what I assume to be the how they made the movie and how they cobbled the movie together is essentially what you're seeing in the movie. Like it's like Paul Dano constructing these cheap ass sets out of magazines and stuff. It's like he's making a little movie for the guy. Like this is independent filmmaking as a metaphor.
And it's really beautiful. Like the trash city is gorgeous.
Awesome. Yeah.
And really, that's really good art direction.
Yeah, it is.
Probably really cheap.
Yeah. These guys
but they
are
probably
incredibly
spent
talented,
some time to make that.
Yeah.
They spent because they had probably not many people on set, but they sat there and they took their time to make that trash look beautiful.
Yeah.
And they did it with trash. They probably just went to the garbage dump and made it.
Yeah, I haven't seen their interim film. Didn't get a lot of play. That's the Death of Dick Long, which I have not yet seen. Got pretty good reviews.
Is this one of their first films?
This might be their first feature.
I think it is their first feature. Yeah.
They made a couple of famous music videos. If you've never seen the video for "Turn Down for What," it is fucking hysterical. And it's just this dude humping everything he sees. It's extremely funny. I think they come basically from a music video background and then and maybe some short films, and then they hopped
now do,
the,
do they have oh here's another weird thing about this movie. Did you see the credits and the production companies involved?
No.
Method.
Oh, no. Okay. Shit, interesting. Okay.
Yeah,
great.
So Method and Company 3 were involved in this movie. So I have a feeling they got a lot of effects done.
Yeah.
And they were trying to get, this was back in the time when visual effects studios were trying to become production companies and they would get involved in weird little movies like this one or Secondhand Lions and stuff like that. Yeah. It is cool, but it doesn't work, which is financially, it doesn't work.
Didn't play for them, but
they probably made. They probably spent a bunch of money, and they maybe got their money back. Maybe,
right?
Because this movie probably made how much? It probably made nothing.
I don't think this one hit. I think that people are discovering this now, post Everything Everywhere.
But I'm not sure you think so?
Yeah, I think this sort of slipped by because I try to get people to see this, and people are just like, all right, that sounds dumb.
Swiss Army Man 2016. Okay.
What was the
all
budget?
It says it made $4 million.
Yeah.
Total.
I imagine it was probably like what was the budget? Maybe 10, 8?
3.
Oh, that's good. Nice. That is a dark cheap movie. Good.
Yeah.
Good.
Budget was 3. It made 4. Opening weekend was 100,000.
Yeah. So it was
the print in advertising was $75 million.
Yeah, it has Harry Potter. You can't.
There was definitely no advertising in this film, for sure.
I can't get enough of it. Like, because the other guy is Elijah Wood, the Frodo from Lord of the Rings. Like, he just makes like weird horror movies now. I'm like,
yeah,
That's how to do it.
It has the financial stability to take chances, and that's really being a great artist.
That's incredible. I think that the upper level of that same thing is what Kristen Stewart and Robert Pattinson have done, which is like they did their time in the Twilight movies, and then
time in Twilight,
and now they make nothing but great films and art films. I'm just like that's how to think about it. Just like okay. I'll do my time, but I will get the payoff at the end, right?
Yeah.
I'm sure Twilight made him a ton
of money. And one of these days, I highly recommend Twilight, man.
I'm up
fucking
for it.
Hysterical, man. Yeah, they're great.
We'll keep saying we're up for it, but we'll just not let it happen.
Oh my god.
You don't want it to happen, Chris.
I don't have the time.
If you have the time to watch bad movies, you have time to watch Twilight, which is a great movie.
Yeah, I haven't watched a bad. This was not a bad movie. This was a good movie.
It's a great movie.
I was curious about it, and I have to say the one I've heard about. I've been been in the back of my mind for a long time to see this movie, and then it came up. A friend of mine, Chris, we were out, and he's like, "Have you seen Swiss Army Man?" He's like, "It's pretty good." I was like, okay, yeah, I'll see it. And so I saw it, and I was like, oh, I'm going to see this. Chris told me about it.
Let's do it.
And then finally I saw it, and I was like, oh, fuck, this is good. How did I miss it?
Yeah.
Why didn't I see this sooner? 2016. Exactly. This is an 8-year-old film.
You could be saying that after doing a Twilight Festival.
There's no way I'm going to be saying that after Twilight
Festival. Why didn't I let them do it sooner?
Right. I tell you, man. No, Twilight, because I'll tell you, the secret of Twilight is everyone making Twilight thinks Twilight is a really bad, weird idea. And that's what makes the movies fantastic.
The tree stuff is so good.
They're insane. I can't even describe how crazy those movies are.
How they go up the trees is magical.
Once you embrace it, it's the funniest, most amazing thing you've ever seen. Yeah, it's unbelievable. And everybody is in on the joke except for the woman who wrote the original books.
Accountant is very happy.
Oh, very happy. Like, this is her weird Freudian dream, and it's just laid out for over the course of, 6 hours? My god, it's more than that, probably 8 hours. And it's just stunning. Like the stuff they unembarrassedly put on screen it's gripping. Absolutely.
You know what?
Gripping.
Those producers were like, we're just a machine churning out this crap. It's like, how many ho-hos can we make in one day?
Oh, if they made ho-hos this weird and silly, like I would eat ho-hos every day. Like there's a point, don't get off track, but like, the last two movies, the second to last movie of Twilight is basically a cancer pregnancy drama.
Nice.
About a vampire baby. Then the last one is about when that baby is born. When the baby is born, her werewolf almost boyfriend falls in love with it. Like when you're getting to that point in filmmaking, you're like, we can do anything.
We can do anything.
We can do anything at all. Werewolf falls in love with a baby.
But we were just talking about a movie about a guy who rides a dead corpse.
Exactly.
As a jet ski.
Exactly. You feel unlimited when you watch those movies. They're so fun. They're so fun.
Yeah. But I bet you they had Chateaubriand when they were doing this on set.
It may be a Chateaubriand movie. I'll give you that.
You know, it's so funny. I told you that I talked to Kevin Mack about Too Much Escargot. He says, you know, I still can't eat escargot to this day.
He's hit a wall. He's hit a snail wall.
Snail pace. But yeah, there was a lot of really hilarious, sweet, and just sad. And the music was great.
Oh, it's beautiful.
I don't know where they got the music.
Some really eclectic choices. Really great soundtrack. And like this is it's obviously the
kind of
thing.
Go listen to Pet Sounds, Chris.
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah, very definitely. And
everybody listen to Pet Sounds.
It's an inspiring movie just in terms of being a filmmaker. Like you can't not respond to a movie like this with anything but fucking attaboy, man. Like that's how to do it. It's so exciting.
It's like, oh, I want to make a weird movie and here's how I'm going to do it. I'm going to make it super cheap. And everyone's going to have a good time. I bet you when they were on set, everyone was having a blast. Day was so much fun.
Yeah.
A good adventure.
Blast. Yeah. Like, you know what wasn't so much fun? When they were making Killers of the Flower Moon, I bet you it wasn't fun on set.
Oh, God.
I cannot describe I can describe it. Paul Schrader, who's a friend of Martin Scorsese, summed up Killers of the Flower Moon so flawlessly. He said, 3 hours is a lot of time to spend with a moron.
That's very funny. Did he really say that?
Did you see the movie, Eric?
No, I haven't seen it
Jesus
yet.
Christ.
It was so horrible. That's why I didn't see it.
There's moments where, I mean, Scorsese is very skilled, and there's moments that are interesting. But the overall, it's just like, why is this story happening?
Do you think Scorsese's too old?
I don't know. He's like, he hasn't gotten lazy. It's just,
yeah,
like,
but maybe he's just, you know, I'm not saying he's senile or anything. I'm just saying, like,
it's indiscriminate.
Stuck in a way of doing things. He's right. Like, he's struggling.
Well, that's fine. That's fine to be stuck in a way, I guess. But I think also the audience has changed.
Yeah.
His perception of violence and his, you know, the way he approaches things with, you know, religious tones and so forth. He's doing is regurgitation of the themes which he made his career from.
Like, there's a reason why when he works in closer to home stuff for him, like, he's excited by it, and his filmmaking gets really adventurous. But when he starts making movies like this, like, it feels like a sort of inventive bad Oscar bait film.
It's total Oscar bait.
It's a real grind. It's like it feels like a mid 80s Oscar movie.
So let me ask you this because Apple spend a fuck ton of money on movies, Oscar bait movies, right? Well, not all Oscar bait, but sure. Like Killers of the Flower Moon was one of them.
Yeah. Right.
They did Argyle. They did another one. It was clearly they're like trying to find, I forgot what other ones, but
yeah, they're
but,
trying to get in the Netflix game. Like, let's win some awards. Right.
So this is an interesting thing because there's a push or a desire by big tech company heads,
mm-hmm.
like the Tim Cooks.
Yeah.
And even I venture to bet the Jensen Yang, who's the CEO of NVIDIA, mm-hmm. I would almost guarantee that someone like him wants to win an Oscar.
Sure. Yeah. Like there's an artistic validation kind of thing happening.
Yeah.
You know, and I feel like the
billionaires winning Oscars.
Billionaires winning
because
Oscars,
I have a feeling that there's something about the tech industry, specifically the Silicon Valley area that those specific billionaires, as opposed to like the Walmart people or the Koch brothers or whatever, they feel that they are contributing to the creative world in some ways, like the iPhone and NVIDIA's creates graphic software, video games.
They're contributing to culture. All these things are being made. All this
culture
great stuff
is, a good
is
way
being
to say
made
it.
With tools that I've created. So why can't I? So what I'm going to do is just buy my way in and then I'll get it. But that's basically what it is. And
because Bezos making Amazon
Lord
TV?
Of the Rings.
Why?
Oh my God. Like that Lord of the Rings show is
season two.
The most expensive mistake I've ever seen.
That's a lot of Chateaubriand. That's a like, lot of Chateaubriand.
Oh my God. The quality of that production in terms of like what you get out of it is about the level of early 2000s sci-fi channel. That is the level of writing that it is. Right. And that's being kind because a sci-fi channel is making Battlestar Galactica at the time. And that's a good show. Not that. I mean, like, this is like Sword of Shannara kind of stuff.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
And the ungodly amount of money visible on the screen to support this sub seventh grade play is like, what the fuck are you doing? Like this could feed the poor. This could do anything. Why are you doing this way? This is so very, very bad. It's so flagrant and so undisciplined. And then you see something like fucking Swiss Army Man, which costs $1 million. You're like, I'm crying. Like that's the difference. Right?
I know.
And I think your way into beauty.
So this is kind of one of the other reasons I like this movie, especially now that we're recording this the day before the Oscars. So we don't know how well Poor Things will do at the Oscars. Swiss Army Man was definitely not recognized for any Oscar situations.
Yep. Right.
But, and even though Swiss Army Man did not necessarily do great at the box office. I have a feeling that movies like this down the road are going to be recognized more and more and more and more and more.
Oh, they're right? Certainly the people ones are going to look at things,
Everything Everywhere, Godzilla, right. The Creator. No, The Creator didn't make a lot of money at the box office either, but I.
Well, The Creator's going to have a very big impact in the system because it was so fucking cheap and it looked that great.
Right.
Like,
well, that's the same thing with Everywhere. They're efficient filmmaking.
Yes.
So that efficiency is just spilling over. And that's the way everybody wants it.
Yes. And I think when people say, okay, I have a story to tell and I'm only going to build what I see in my fucking front of my face.
Yeah. Yeah.
That's legit,
Gareth Edwards is like I said, The Creator is a really interesting example because like Creator doesn't work and it's not a good movie, but
it's so well done and then the dialogue, it just falls apart.
Well, you can have shitty dialogue and still have a great movie. There's plenty of James Cameron movies that prove this. It's all about structure and whether you need all the right pieces in the right places. There's like two key scenes missing from The Creator. And because they're not there, there's just no emotion carried through in what should be an obviously emotional story. And it gets annoying by the end. But that said, he has made Monsters is an excellent film. The guy is a really good director.
I love Monsters.
Yeah, it's terrific. And he directs like a fucking genius. I'm
going to sneak peek because I recorded a podcast, which is not out yet, with on CG Garage with Julian Levy. And Julian was my VFX producer when I worked with him on Day After Tomorrow and on Stealth as well. He remembers us well. He remembers Eric well. He always liked Eric. He was like, oh, it's great. You guys. And he actually said, he's like, I listened to your Martini Giant. He's like, he didn't know about CG Garage, which to me,
I love
CG Garage, obviously.
Yeah.
You know, way bigger numbers.
CG Garage, the host is.
Yeah, he's very handsome. I know, he's like, oh, I listened to your Apocalypse Now one because like Scott Ross was on. It's like, so it was cool. But Julian was the VFX supervisor on The Creator, and he was the overall VFX supervisor, right? He worked directly with Gareth. And what was interesting on that movie is that they decided not to have an overall VFX supervisor.
Interesting.
So Gareth said, no, I'll just do it myself.
No, that's wild, man. Wow.
So he just sat there and they split up the work amongst a bunch of studios, right?
Sure.
And they had ILM, I think, was supposed to do all of it and they couldn't because it was way too expensive. But ILM had started the foundation of building all the assets and stuff, and then they distributed it amongst a bunch of places. But apparently it was just Gareth and Julian sitting in a screening room for like 18 hours a day as the different studios were coming offline and doing their dailies. And they would just review, and he would just no,
that's
just
crazy.
And apparently he would get so upset when he would see something for the first time that was really far along and it was not the right directions. Like, I could have saved you weeks of work if you'd just come to me sooner.
Yeah.
And it's true. And we've seen it so many times.
Oh, of course. Yeah.
He wants to be, because he understands how visual effects is supposed to work. Now, he said himself, like, I can't do visual effects anymore. I'm way too far out of the loop. But at least he knows what he's looking at. He knows how to critique.
He's got the eye. He knows exactly what to do.
And so to him, he was like, just show it to me now and make it work. And I think that resonated a lot. And obviously that's up for an Oscar for visual effects.
It's so good looking and it was so comparatively inexpensive.
So cheap, right? The darling, of course, the one that's probably going to win is Godzilla Minus One.
Which is another hero story to me. Different kind of hero story.
Same thing, but they are basically, did you see their behind the scenes of that? It was brilliant.
Yeah. It was the director's working in the box, right? He's
35 artists and he's sitting in a chair rolling around from artist to artist, looking at their screens as they're going. And he says, here's how we made it for so cheap. And he had a picture of a stick man, right? And it said director. And then he had a bunch of stick man and another stick man. It said VFX. And he just folded the piece of paper in half. Yes. Like I cut out all the middleman and I made the choice. I saw the Maya scenes. I said, fix this, fix that, done.
Yep. Yep,
exactly. And that's how it gets done fast.
Yeah, because the two things are like one. I mean, Creator is still an expensive movie, but it's the same mindset, and that's why Creator, like, there are movies that cost literally twice as much as the Creator that don't look one fifth as good as the Creator.
Yeah, because it's a bureaucracy. It's just a machine being pumped out.
Well,
it's
look at Marvel stuff, right?
Yeah.
I mean, I hate to put the blame on them, but like, and
put
it's not,
it's a mess,
but it's not the blame. It's not the artist's fault. It's the bureaucracy. Yeah,
exactly. It's the system that is making good artists create junk.
Right.
Like, that is the problem there. I mean, like, let's see, just to get an idea. Okay. I'm going to pull up the numbers for the Creator. Okay, the Creator
didn't make money.
The budget. Okay, the budget.
$60 million.
So $60 million versus Godzilla? Black Widow. How much did Black Widow cost? Don't look.
Black Widow.
How much was Black Widow?
$250,000.
Nope.
$50 million. You mean?
$250 million. Sorry.
More.
Really?
More.
300 million? 400 million?
Nearly 288.5 million.
That's ridiculous. But
that's before P&A. 288.5. And that thing looked like a PS3 video game. Mm-hmm. Like, that was trash, and that's not the artist's fault.
How much did Indiana Jones cost?
Oh, that's 300 over. That's easily 300 over.
Has to be.
Let's see.
The Creator looks gorgeous.
Incredible. It looks incredible. And like, I will go. I'm, like,
well designed,
I,
too.
Yeah. So it's $295 million for Indiana Jones.
Whoa.
And it had $80 million VFX. Like, it was just like, they were terrible, but that wasn't $300 million worth of anything.
Was that ILM too?
Yeah. And the thing is, like, I'm on record. I really enjoyed that Indiana Jones. I saw it twice.
I do too.
Yeah, so it's a good movie. But $300 million, like, that is that at best should be a $60 million movie. You get exactly the same movie. Like, I was just puzzled.
Yeah.
You know. But the thing is, like, with the Creator, not only are the effects great, and I just want to, you know, for Gareth Edwards, like I said, screenplay, fatal flaws. That's a problem. But his actual direction is great. Like, he directs really tight, nicely cut scenes. He knows how to work with actors. He does it all correctly. The one thing that he needs is someone working on that script. Like, he needs to get that
script?
Dialed in. I think he did with somebody else, but it needed another. It needed one more pass. It's missing key pieces that make it tough by the end.
He seems like a really cool guy, though.
But he is like, I guarantee you, because he's actually, what I'm really excited about is he's already got his next gig, and his next gig is a Jurassic Park movie.
Scared of that.
I know. There's reason to be scared, because they have not made a good one decent Jurassic.
They, like, fucked him up when they put him in Godzilla.
In Godzilla, right? But like, Jurassic Park.
Yeah, why
for
is
me,
he returning to that?
Like, because if I think that he wants to see the Jurassic Park movie that I want to see, which has not yet been made, and I hope they let him make that movie.
What is it, Dan? What do you want to see out of Jurassic Park?
That book,
dinosaurs?
The original book, is so fucking cool, adventurous, and scary. I can't believe they made a kids' ride film series out of it.
Well, like, Spielberg made the original.
Yeah, and it's not one of his best movies by quite a fair shot. In fact, my favorite Jurassic Park movie is, up until the last 20 minutes, Jurassic Park 2. Jurassic Park 2 is a real adventure movie, and it's really nicely directed. Spielberg does a great job, and it's only in the last 20 minutes where you're like, okay, this is stupid. And then everyone walked out going, the whole thing was dumb. I'm like, no. Most of it was great. The last 20 minutes were stupid. They were so stupid, you forgot the other 2 hours.
He only did two, right? He did the
he
first
did those two.
Two,
yeah. And then the
well,
third one's
the
kind of
one?
Good. Third who one's the... Joe Johnston, I think.
Yeah.
Solid director. I like that guy.
I like the third
kids.
One.
Yeah. Third one's good. Tight, small. But I believe that Gareth Edwards could make the scary one.
Tia Leone.
With William, what's his name? William H. Macy.
Eric! Eric! Sorry, that's the movie. I just did Jurassic Park 3. Eric!
Oh, God.
Eric!
Alan!
Yeah.
But yeah, like I'm excited for him. I don't mean to be too hard on the script notes. That's the only, I was just sad but to see.
You're going talking about budgets and crazy. I honestly think that Poor Things had spent too much money.
Oh yeah. A little bit.
What was that budget?
I'll get that. Like there's.
I just felt like if he did not have such scope in terms of visual.
$35 million was the budget on it. That's actually not bad.
It's pretty cheap. I feel like that could be, like, imagine if they were working with Swiss Army Man money, that movie might have been tighter.
That's what I'm saying. Yeah. I think if the Two Dans did it, it would have, meaning not Two Dans, but Two Dans budget, I think it would have been a little more effective.
Like, and this is also how I feel about Scorsese. Like the real thing that's wrong with Killers is that it's too fucking expensive. It, like, they're putting all the money on the screen and there's a lot of money and it's just like
the lobster's budget was $4 million.
Yeah, that's what I'm talking about. And the lobster is fucking great.
Killer, go and look at The Killing of Sacred Deer, just out of curiosity.
Okay.
Thank you, Chris.
Killing of the Sacred Deer's budget doesn't seem to want to tell me. $10 million? No, that's box office. Doesn't say what the budget is. I don't know what the budget is.
So let's take a look at that. So Oscars tomorrow. How many of the Oscars films have you guys seen?
Most of them, except
most of them.
In terms of the best,
the
film?
top 10, yeah, for best picture. So
what are the movies? Go ahead.
Okay. The only one I have not seen, and I'm hopefully going to see it tonight, is Zone of Interest, which is made by the guy who did Under the Skin.
Oh, I got to see that. I'm going to watch it.
Definitely want to see that.
He's my favorite director.
I have a hard time watching yet another
Holocaust movie.
Holocaust film.
It's always a tough ride, understandably so.
Yeah. He's such a great director.
But he's
I'm not
a
saying
bona fide
I'm anti-Holocaust or pretending not, but he is a bona fide genius.
The Holocaust movies are by design extremely hard watches, and he is so it is.
I know. And I just think of Kate Winslet, you know, when I went to Oscar and make a Holocaust film.
Yeah. Like you don't like, I agree with you because it is disrespectful to such a huge and tragic event to get away with making a weepy Oscar baby movie. Then you're just abusing the fact that of massive suffering so you can get a shiny toy. I think that's weak. But I don't think that's going to be Glazer's problem because he is a real artist, so 100% real artist.
You know that do you know that they're going to release the Jerry Lee Lewis movie?
Oh, the Jerry Lewis movie, the Day the Clown Cried.
Yeah.
Oh my God, I thought they would never release that.
They're going to
release
it in 2024.
I'm very interested in that. That is an interesting. Yeah. Like I'm not up till King of Comedy. I'm not a fan of his, but
I wasn't a fan, but I want to see that. I love King of Comedy. Him and Kimmy.
He is perfect.
Jerry Langford.
Yeah. Yeah. He is flawless. And that revealed, because like that movie revealed who he really is in a really interesting way that makes me think maybe he made a good movie and it scared him.
It was typecasted.
Yeah.
You're talking about the Day the Clown
Cried. Yeah. It's hard to say.
Cried.
Like I wonder if he made a great film and that's why he didn't want it released because it was too, because he obviously hid who he was very thoroughly throughout his life. Like he was like,
what if
he
it
is
just didn't work? He says, maybe. Oh, it just didn't work editorially.
Maybe.
But I think there's something more to that. I mean, he basically sucked. He basically assumed all the debt on that.
Yeah. That's
so
pretty big.
That's a big thing. So I don't know. I'm curious to see it. And I think it's one of those, you're going to walk out and say, oh, I know why he didn't release it, but the premise is enough to make you.
No, I'm just for film history. I'm interested in that thing. That sounds good. Because I'm a giant fan. I really enjoyed Benigni's movie, which is basically the same movie. I thought that was a really brilliant, sweet, sad film. So let's see. Next up was Poor Things. We've talked about Poor Things. Mm-hmm. Past Lives. Did you guys see Past Lives?
Mm-mm.
I'm in the strong minority in this. I did not like Past Lives. I thought it was very boring. I didn't like the characters.
Past Lives.
That's the with the couple that reconnects from childhood. From Korea and South Korea. They reconnect in New York City. I thought it was dull, uninteresting, and amateurish, and I didn't finish watching it. I'm told that it is great, but I ran out of patience, and I meant to catch up with it again, but I was just like, I was really irritated by it.
Okay.
Oppenheimer, obviously.
Yep.
Big one. This is, for me, like, I don't emotionally connect with this movie, but I also think it's an incredibly well-made movie. And so if it wins, I'm like, yeah, it's a great movie. I just don't, like...
Oppenheimer?
I don't feel swept up in Oppenheimer, but I was just like, it's fucking perfectly made. It's a great film.
I think it's a beautiful film.
Yeah, it's really nicely made. I really actually love but the thing I really love in Oppenheimer is with all the riding around to horses in New Mexico. Make a Western, dude. That looks incredible. That looks great.
Yeah.
Maestro, I loved Maestro. I'm the only one. I'm the guy. Cooper is.
I haven't seen it, but Cooper is as a director.
Mm-hmm. I think it's a brilliant movie. I think it's incredibly heartfelt. It's an autobiographical movie for Cooper, and I think that it's so open and so honest about his need for congratulations that it's sort of sad that he's getting shredded for it at the same time.
They shred him because he's good looking, talented, and
he's being very open and very emotional about his Oscar campaign. And people are embarrassed by this, and so they started shredding him and the movie. And I'm just like, it's kind of shitty. Like, I think this is a genuinely good movie. But even if you don't like it, you don't have to be a dick about it. And but people are, it's the internet. What are you gonna do? But I think it's very powerful. I think it's a good movie. Killers of the Flower Moon, very boring. Very boring. Wow. Holdovers, we like that one.
Loved it.
Yeah, I was a very big fan of that. That was great. Saw it twice. Barbie, good stuff.
Yeah.
Good stuff in Barbie. Anatomy of a Fall.
I gotta see that.
That's good. It's very solid. I'm not sure why it has such sort of, push behind it. I was just like, well, it's a pretty good legal thriller that didn't ring any other bells, but it's a pretty good movie.
Sorry, I had to walk away. Maestro, what was after Maestro?
Killers of the Flower Moon.
Okay, yeah.
Legal Eagles.
Legal Eagles. Yes, that's right. Nice callback to Mr. Redford. Killers of the Flower Moon, Holdovers.
Yes, loved it.
Which we loved. Barbie.
Mm-hmm.
And we were just talking about Anatomy of a Fall, which I liked a lot.
Barbie's still nominated for Best Film.
Yeah.
I got snubbed. It's like, it's still nominated for best movie of the year.
I think it's in the right spot. I think that
she's a good director.
She's a great director.
She's not going to win.
Unless they win
because it's a political thing. Like Barbie should win because they didn't get that's the problem I have with the Oscars.
She should win for something like Little Women, which is fucking great. Little Women is, that's a great film and she did an incredible job with it. If she were to win for best director for this one, she's not going to, obviously, because she's not nominated. But if she were to win, there should be a separate award for doing the best job you possibly can with something that's almost impossible.
new category.
How did you make it this good, even though it's not the best movie ever?
But the beauty about Barbie is that she probably made so much money from it that she really have creative freedom.
Anything
now.
She wants. She Anything deserves she wants. It. I'm very happy for her. I can't wait to see what she does next. She's amazing. And then finally, American Fiction, which I liked.
I like American Fiction.
Yeah, it was very funny.
I thought it was very good. I don't know how it gets to Best Film of the Year, but it's there.
Yeah, it's just a good movie. It's a good, solid movie with great great characters.
It's a very good film. I'd watch it. Yeah. I'll watch it over and over again.
Yeah.
No problem.
Yeah.
But
really enjoyed it.
Then why do you have a problem? I'm not trying to be caustic. Why do you have a problem with it being you're just, you don't think it's up to the level of,
it's Oscar. Not like listen, you put Oppenheimer and then you put these, and I'm not, and they're just such different classes of film. It's just crazy, you know?
Yeah. Like it feels like a really good, maybe if I saw this on HBO as a HBO movie, I'd be like, oh, that's a really good, that's a good little movie, as right. opposed to like, you know, it's not a very tight movie. It's not like, it has a really good idea that
it's
does
got
a
great
good job
message.
With.
It's very important.
Yeah,
it's very good.
Like, they have some really solid things to say. They don't put a lot of force behind it. They just sort of say stuff that you go like, "Oh, that's, I'm glad this got said. This is interesting."
Mm-hmm. Good acting, it's fantastic.
Good acting. Jeffrey Wright is fucking great.
And his brother is incredible.
Yeah, totally great. And so it's like it's a low key, pretty well made, good movie that, you know, it's not that it shouldn't be on the list, and just like, you know, I saw better made movies this year than this. It's just a very good movie.
Mm-hmm.
But it's a lot of the list. I'm just, for me, it's just like American Fiction, Anatomy of Fall, Barbie, Killers of the Flower Moon, Past Lives, and On the Cusp, Poor Things are like, these are all good, but didn't we have anything of greater caliber than this? Like, say, John Wick 4?
Well, I think this... I don't know. I still think that there were some really amazing things that got made. I have hope for the future. I think...
Yes.
No, yeah, I'm with you.
I actually... I know people are horrified by the situation in Hollywood, the strikes and the pandemic and the streaming and all of these things that are problematic. But I have a feeling that
the indicators are strong for a creative,
a new
recovery.
Hollywood, yes, a new way of working and efficient filmmaking. And you look at all the signs, right?
Yeah.
You look at things like Godzilla Minus One. You look at things like The Creator. You look at things even like, you know, Man, which is 8 years ago.
The two Dans.
Everything
always.
You know, everywhere.
All at once. Yeah. Even though I did not like the movie, I'm glad that movies like Past Lives are in the mix, because that is a very small, very indie movie. And here it is in Best Picture land. I'm just like, you know, definitely, you know, if you're thinking about watching it. Everyone loves it. I'm just, it hit me wrong. Fuck me. It doesn't make any difference. It's good that this movie got in there. Mm-hmm. Like, that's a big positive thing. So I'm definitely supported in that way. And that just shows that things are turning in a positive, smaller, tighter, more interesting direction than Marvel. You know, it's breaking away from the things that have been slowing creativity down in massive ways for the past literal 10 years.
So it's funny, even though we all watched these two films, I was really curious to see what you guys think of them. And I think it's funny that we, and correct me if I'm wrong, but we all seem to say we kind of like Poor Things. We had a lot of little random things that are wrong with it, but we all seem to like Army Man. Army Man seems to be a film that we like even more.
It was, that's, it was just, it hit. I think it's Dan might have touched it, or you have, but I just, it hit a lot of emotional buttons.
Yeah.
And the weird thing was, is that Poor Things had those setups, and then it just kind of didn't
follow through. Was a little
didn't follow through on it. Yeah, you're like, why? Yep. And I think the director is so great that he must have been overwhelmed by like the production side, like how big it was, that it's like it kind of got, he tripped over it.
Yeah, I think that the theme for me with this year's Oscars is like there's a bunch of movies here that should have been much better than they are. And like they're so like some of their great performances, there's some great stuff all over the place. But I'm like, why are these good, like, good directors making such undercooked experiences.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a lot of that. And I think, like, for instance, I recommend Killers of the Flower Moon for the moments that it gets right. You're like, oh, that's right. This is Martin Scorsese. This is good. And there are moments like that. But overall, I'm just like, I feel like a lot of these things were made by tired people. And Swiss Army Man wakes you up. Like, it excites you and it makes you want to go make
a movie. I think it's because we love the idea of what it takes to make a movie too. Yeah. And we see that like, oh fuck. Think of like, you see yourself like, I want to make that movie.
Yeah. Like you want to be on the set working that thing. Cause it's goddamn fun. Like that. Looks
You're
fun.
Like, oh my God. Can I just wish I could be making that movie.
The thing is too, it's like, we're out of COVID. The world is so fractured right now. Hollywood is so these guys making this movie, they're just as nervous and mm-hmm. have no sense of future, because what's in the future is so they're making choices that, you know, they're making mistakes in their choices because
they're building Avatar lands in Disneyland.
Yeah, come on, man. Like, the thing is, like, when you look at
the only reason they bought,
Dan,
the only reason they bought
point,
Fox,
though. It's
yeah.
there's a lot of uncertainty that affects everybody, even
everybody.
Top directors.
Absolutely, yeah.
And
absolutely
so they're making
true.
Choices. Just be like, man, I might not be directing in 5 years.
Yeah, absolutely
and,
true.
So you know, maybe they're doing it for money. Maybe they're doing it for, but
oh, I certainly think that executives are doing that.
Yeah, it's like
they're
it's
cashing some, out right yeah, now. Oh right. My,
oh
god.
My god,
so many
golden
people are cashing out.
Golden parachutes galore, man. It's like it looks like the invasion of France. It's golden parachutes just kind of like all over the place. But like, yeah, it's like this, like something like Swiss Army Man is so exciting. And those guys are exciting, in not just in the indie film way, but with that and Everything Everywhere, they have a strong positive, a feel good, exciting message that doesn't feel unearned. Like the movie earns it. That's why it's good. Like it has a positive thing to say, but it's not just sort of like saying it and going, hey, we all agree, hooray. Like it makes you work for it, and it puts you through the emotions the way you want a movie to do. Like like Everything Everywhere, like I dare people to not cry when you see the Stones talk to each other. I dare you. It's impossible. Like David Blaine couldn't do it. It's not even possible.
Yeah.
And like that's what,
two stones.
This is just a couple of fucking rocks and you're crying. Like that's the energy that those guys bring. It's unbelievably exciting. And Swiss Army Man, you know, it's the small scale first time film version of that, but it's got all the energy in the right place. It's fantastic.
It does. And you can see the genius of them like coming out.
Absolutely.
But I still stand by, I think it was a heroin addict, but I'm completely
I'm
wrong.
With you, man.
Still,
that's a great read.
Still stands, still stands no matter how you look at it.
Yeah.
I just see him as schizophrenic.
Mm-hmm.
But
Either way plays to me, but the feeling is still there regardless. That's the important
thing. Yeah. And you're just like, oh, when they're running through chasing him and they go through the, you basically, it's like you've taken like this, you know, 2 hour journey through this entire long thing. And at the end, you race through it in 30 seconds. It's like,
30 seconds.
And like you just rewind the whole film in like 30 seconds. And you realize how close you've been the whole time. And that journey,
which is a statement unto itself.
Of course it is.
It's just great.
So simple.
Yeah.
And I think that's the great story about it. You know, you don't, there, is there a save the cat in this plot? I don't know, but it certainly works as a story. It's such a simple narrative and it's so great.
Right.
And it doesn't have to be, you know, Miss Congeniality of a generic plot that it is.
Although I do love Miss Congeniality. But
sure,
yes, I get what you're
fine.
Saying.
That's fine, right? That's because Miss Congeniality is built very much on a save the cat map, like
absolutely.
Structure,
absolutely.
Right?
It hits all the right notes. Yeah, exactly. That's how to do it. That's how to do it.
It's almost like, you just done.
Yep. Like, because that's the thing is like, the reason why Save the Cat isn't good or bad. It just tells you there
this
are
works.
Notes. Yeah, this works. Like there are notes that people need to feel. There's things that people need to feel. And if you compare Poor Things
to,
yeah, exactly. Well, it's just like you need to have a setup and a payoff in order for this to sell you the emotion it's selling. Right.
Sure.
You can't have the payoff without the setup, and you can't have the setup without the payoff.
Sure.
And Poor Things, for instance, which I really liked and really enjoyed, has a lot of setups that have no payoff.
Right? That's right.
And so like it could have had a little more save the cat. They could have tuned it into that a little bit more to be sensitive to this. Whereas Swiss Army Man, like it's all over the place, but it does have these key moments which you do want in the story that make you go, I got you. As dumb and weird as this is and farts galore, like I'm emotionally sold.
By the way, did you notice that the scene where he arrives at the house and the ambulance, all that's a one giant fucking oneer?
It's insane. I did not notice that. That's great.
You did not?
I did not notice
it's
that.
It's a huge oneer.
The best oneers
so
are the ones
epic.
You don't notice. The best oneers are the ones you don't
epic.
Notice.
Epic.
It's true.
Yeah. Yeah.
Man, it is so amazing.
Like, I always appreciate it.
Because when his dad arrives and the reporter's there, and then the sound is coming and out and the chaos is happening and it's all a oneer. It's amazing.
That's great blocking. If that's happening, that's great blocking. Because like I love a good oneer. Even when when you notice that it's a oneer and you're like, oh, it's a oneer, so let's see how long it goes. That's perfectly
fine. But especially when you do oneers that are chaotic.
When you do not notice it's a oneer, then you have done it correctly. Mm-hmm. Like it's just like the one I was talking about. There is a oneer in Poltergeist that's clearly staged by Spielberg. And I mean, he didn't direct the movie.
He's a king of blocking, man.
Like. He blocked. He clearly had influence of the blocking, where it's like
he used to play with blacks as a kid.
It's like, swear to God, it's like it's the lead up to the psychic woman opening the door to the bedroom, right? And the whole family and the crew is there, and the way he keeps reframing and reframing and reframing until you're on the goddamn doorknob. I must have seen this like 50 times before. I was like, wait, is this all one shot? And it's absolutely fucking perfect. That's gold standard right there. I didn't see it. If I didn't see it, they're better filmmakers than I even give them credit for making this.
Spielberg is so good.
Yeah.
For fundamentals of filmmaking.
I think my favorite filmmaker is a different answer. I think he is the second. I think that he is the second best director who has ever lived. And that does not mean that I like all of his movies or I think his movies are perfect. No. But in terms of
capturing the audience,
staging a scene and blocking what you're seeing.
I agree with you.
There's nobody like him. Orson Welles is the only one who beats him. That's it.
Right. There's a scene in Minority Report. Colin Farrell walks in, and the dynamic between Colin Farrell and Tom Cruise, and they're having a debate, and it's all in one shot.
It's unreal.
You can see how just by the way they're blocked out in terms of their actions, how the dynamic changes from who's in power in the conversation.
Yeah, incredible. Perfectly directed movie.
It's well acted, but it's blocked in terms of at this point you go here, at this point you go there, boop, 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 and then you just feel the emotions happening just by how they're positioning themselves in the shot.
Yeah, it's brilliant. It's incredible. And the thing is, I had a recent realization about Spielberg, because it was after Fablemans came out, and I thought that Fablemans was a very good movie, and it really says, please go back and watch my movies with the lens of thinking of me as a very weirdo artist. Like, that's what it's asking you to do. And so I basically did this. And there's movies that I sort of didn't credit before that I now like a lot more of his. But it's what's really weird is, like, there's three distinct sections of his career for me now, right? His very best movies are still... Jaws, Close Encounters, and Raiders of the Lost Ark, and
Close
E.T.
Encounters
Close Encounters is my favorite movie by him, bar none.
My favorite movie by him as well.
And it's just an American classic, one of the best movies ever made. But what's interesting, after E.T., he enters this sort of like trying to recapture that mode and trying to be seen as a serious filmmaker mode. And that lasts all the way up until 9/11, right? And so it's this big, long time where he's making pretty good movies, occasionally good ones, and all the stuff, and some really, like, a couple of great ones.
Schindler's List.
Which is a great movie. Yeah, like, these are
Saving really Private Ryan.
Yeah, great movies. But these are trying for something movies, right? 9/11 happens, and then all of the movies after that, whether they're wobbly or the scripts aren't done or whatever the fuck it is, that is his most interesting work. Like, it's not his best work in terms of a whole movie, but after that point, he is doing the craziest, most inventive bullshit of his entire career. Movie after movie. Munich, War of the Worlds, Minority Report, everything. Absolutely fucking wild, right? And I realized the first third of his movie-making career, he is making these flawless movies because it's like in Good Will Hunting when Matt Damon, like... walks in, gives Stellan Skarsgård the paper, and it's like, here it is, that's right. And he's like, I'm not sure if these are right, Will. He's like, it's right, check it. Do you know how hard it is to watch you, like, for me to watch you fumble around and fuck this up? And this is Spielberg coming in and saying, I'll play by your rules. I'll make a studio film and I'll show you that I can do this better than you could ever make them. Like, he makes studio movies during that period that are clearly John Ford experiences. And he's like, I'm better than all of these motherfuckers. Goodbye. Right. But when he starts after 2001, after 9/11, he becomes an independent filmmaker who is making the movies he wants to make.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm like, this is where I love his work from everything he's doing now. Whether it's a good movie or a bad movie, it's a fucking fascinating movie. And he's on fire. West Side Story? His West Side Story blew my mind. I don't like that musical. Like, I'm not a fan of it at all. But that movie was outrageously well directed. It blew my mind. The guy's on fire. The guy's on fire. And he's like, what, 75?
Yeah.
Something like that. Incredible work.
Yeah. Well, Scorsese's probably older.
Yeah,
and so is Ridley Scott, and he's still. Oh, that was the other Apple movie, was Napoleon.
Oh yeah, Napoleon, which I actually loved. I thought it was really funny. It was a good funny movie.
No, I was like, you think you're special because you have boats?
It's fucking hysterical, man. Great battle scenes, and him like
having a tantrum because he wants to have sex with his wife while they're sleeping in the room.
You're like, this is amazing. That is a very. I recommend Napoleon highly. That is a very, very funny movie, and it's intentionally funny. It is intentionally funny.
Amazing visual effects.
Oh,
amazing
it's like that. Joaquin
Phoenix. Yes.
Joaquin. Yeah. He was like that in Gladiator. I'm vexed.
Yes,
it was
I'm
the
vexed.
Same
yeah.
kind of like comedic, it's a, serious.
Yeah, it's a very mocking performance. Yeah.
Mocking performance. Yeah. He was doing that back then for Ridley Scott.
Yeah. He did. And I think he's terrific, Napoleon. I think Napoleon, if you look at it the right way, I think people want it to be a different kind of film than it is. And so they don't know what to do with it. But if you watch it as a comedy, it's extremely funny. And very, it's sort of like weirdly sad that it's so funny. By the end, you're like, this poor fucking dope. Yeah. It's really good.
But there's also no VFX in it. So that's the other
Not thing. At all. All the horses were real horses.
No, come on. Let's go. We've done this conversation because we got to wrap it up. We're almost exactly at 3 hours. Done. Yay.
Nicely done. Nice day, everybody. Good stuff.
Well,
good
job.
Stuff.
Well, job. All right. Well, thank you guys so much for doing this. These are two stories about dead people that we covered, Poor Things and Swiss Army Man. You know, make sure that it's sometimes it's better off to be dead, which is another film we can talk about.
Oh,
God. This is true.
Yeah.
All right. Well, thank you, everybody in chat.
Thanks, everybody. Remember to join our Discord. If you don't know what our Discord link is, it's on the, all of our YouTubes have a link in our description files. Just click on that.
That's great. Hold up the camera.
I can't see it. It's the camera does not like to.
Yeah, that's beautiful. Love it.
Did a lot of drawing tonight.
Nice. Okay.
That's awesome. We are working on a big project together, which is coming up. I can't wait to start talking about it. I'm going to start asking if I can start talking about it. I will probably ask it.
It's going to be fun.
It's going to be fun. It is related to chaos. Let's just put it that way. I am working.
The concept word is, it's called Operation Excise Tax.
Yes. Nice. I am Beautiful. Working very closely with Vlado on this. I'll just put it that way. So just think of this. Martini Giant and Vlado working together on a big, big, fun, creative project.
Exciting.
It's going to be very exciting.
Yeah.
And yeah. Lots of, well, Vlado as part of chaos, obviously.
Yes,
that's right. Also should be mentioned. But a lot of other people.
We'll say more soon.
But it's going to be fun. Yeah. So, all right, you guys ready?
Yes.
Drink.
Talk. Drink.